You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 47 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations again this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the AOS champion, Seattle Mariners.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
I thought it was home of the DVOA leader.
That
Seattle
is true.
Seahawks.
Also, I was looking up Joe Jurevicius's number, and I have confirmed it is the Joe Jurevicius edition of the Pelton Cast, as always.
Can I give you a weird one? Do you know who I had for 87?
Who is that?
Sean Dawkins.
Oh, yeah.
We are going deep into the archives on these ones.
It's time to go way back.
Jonathan is like, who are these guys? That's the young listener on the Discord.
That is Super Bowl XL participant Joe Jurevicius to you. Thank you.
Joe Jurevicius was really good for the Seahawks that season. And you know who else they're hoping is going to be very good for them as a receiver? It's Rashid Shaheed.
There
you
we go.
With
wow.
A variety
what a
of
transition.
Options there. Wow. Who the Seahawks acquired on Tuesday at the NFL trade deadline from the New Orleans Saints. Do you want to do this semi-emergency pod style off the top and talk about the Rashid Shaheed trade?
No, I don't. But what
okay.
I do want to do is, this could have been discussed offline. I don't know.
You know what?
We famously don't speak to each other, but...
I will say, I've looked up the jersey spreadsheet. Joe Jurevicius is in there under 87. So I guess he is the most famous Seattle 87.
He's the only one you had in there.
He's the only one.
Wow. There we go.
One of one.
I mean, I remember Joe Jurevicius all the way back to Penn State.
I'm not even joking.
Weird, I do remember Joe Jurevicius. So,
you know what? You know what the problem is with my Sean Dawkins one?
What's that?
He did not wear 87 for the Seahawks. He wore 87 during his stint with the Indianapolis Colts, which is surely where that triggered in my head, but not during his 2 years with your Seattle Seahawks.
It's the opposite of Joe Jurevicius, who only wore 87 with the Seahawks.
Did he wear 84 elsewhere?
86, 84, 84, 83, 84, mostly 84.
Okay. I feel good about that one. We're making a comeback with remembering Joe Jurevicius's number with other teams.
There we go. No, I don't, though. And how okay. I do want to do it is I want to do all of our normal intro, and then I think I'm going to propose this to you. I think we slot into that Mariners slot where you know, the Mariners, they're still there, right? The Mariners aren't gone, but I think we slot into that Mariners spot right after we help pick Seattle's best cookie, right after we do the toasts. I think we slot the Seahawks in there, and I think we finish with the Huskies until the end of the Husky season.
Okay. Well, there is a format change that, at least for this week, that would make that appropriate. So we begin with our
format toast. Change. Okay.
I mean, you don't think that's how I'd describe it?
All right.
You don't think it's a fair description? We start with a congrats to NFC Offensive Player of the Month, Jaxon Smith-Njigba, who had 417 yards and 3 touchdowns in the month of October, despite playing just 3 games due to the Seahawks bye. Obviously carried over that success in his first game of November as the Seahawks beat the Washington Commanders on Sunday Night Football. Jason, more and more people saying it, just the best wide receiver in football. Just casually. The best wide receiver in football.
Odds for Offensive Player of the Year, Jonathan Taylor is still number one, who I will forever call Jonathan Smith.
Okay.
Number two, right there, Jaxon Smith-Njigba. It's really a two-man race at this point. It is Christian McCaffrey's plus 600, JSN's plus 350, and Jonathan Taylor's minus 135. It is straight up, it is Jonathan Taylor or it is Jaxon Smith-Njigba. There's almost no argument to be made that he isn't the best receiver in football.
I mean, I'm sure that you could come up with some arguments. I was looking at the NFL, the ESPN analytics receiver scores because of the fact that they came up in the trade grade for Rashid Shaheed. And it turns out that JSN's ESPN analytics scores kind of mid. Now, obviously, that's not more important than the production, not anywhere near as important as the production, but I suppose if you were going to make an argument, you would go with that and just like the track record is not there of him producing at this level, but he is producing at this level. And oh, at this level is he producing. So a quarterback has not won this award since Patrick Mahomes in 2018. It definitely has become the best skill position player in the NFL.
It's the MVPs for quarterbacks. This is for everybody else.
Because obviously quarterbacks are the most valuable players. So, yeah, I mean, it's nice to have an award for that running backs can win sometimes. Sure.
Have you seen also Defensive Rookie of the Year voting? Our numbers?
I have not.
Abdul Carter plus 145. Two players are tied at plus 300. Nicky Manwari is one of those players.
Wow.
Is that crazy? Jahad Campbell and Nicky Manwari right there at plus 300 for Defensive Rookie of the Year, within striking distance of Abdul Carter, depending on how these next 2 months go.
I mean, not that Nicky Manwari hasn't played incredibly well, because he has, but for some of the Seahawks rookies who didn't get Defensive Rookie of the Year consideration because they weren't edges who were putting up double-digit sacks, for Manwari to win it, well, not even beginning the year really as a starter, would be quite amusing, I would say.
I mean, for missing a chunk of games, he started the season as a starter, was injured on like the third defensive play of the season, and then it's been out.
It's all true.
So it's been an incredible run there. And Sean Schneider's been doing a great job. I mean, both of these players, like players that he drafted, but that's Jackson Smith and Jigba, who we're talking about right now.
Sean Schneider did a great job drafting him. Yeah. I mean, Sunday was definitely, it was a triumph for the Seattle Seahawks writ large, but Sean Schneider specifically, a lot of his moves shining on Sunday. All right, congrats to number 16 at UW's women's soccer, which advanced to the semifinals of the Big Ten tournament with Sunday's 2-0 win over Illinois in West Lafayette. They'll face Wisconsin Thursday in St. Louis, which is odd because St. Louis does not really seem to be part of Big Ten country, although Big Ten country is obviously a variable thing, is the top seed after winning the Big Ten.
I love that you would go
season.
Out of your way. That would be the thing that would shock you, is saying that another city, which is much closer to Big Ten country than Seattle, Washington, or Los Angeles.
But like, if you're doing the Big Ten map, St. Louis seems to be like, it's unexplored territory, I guess, if we're doing
the
video.
When they do
the
video, they have to fly over St. Louis to get to the rest of Big Ten country.
They have to fly over a lot of places, too. I don't know that they're going to hold a Big Ten tournament in Salt Lake City anytime soon.
That it's like a hilarious thing to just take offense to. I mean, how far do you think it is
take offense
to?
I'm not saying it's that far. It's just like there's a lot of places that are in the Big Ten. A lot of places are in the Big Ten that you could have played this, and choosing to play in St. Louis is odd.
You said Big Ten country, and it is 225 miles away from Bloomington, Indiana.
I'm not disputing that it's much closer.
It seems like a strange, like, of all things about the Big Ten, the thing that you took offense to, it was the women's soccer tournament being played in St. Louis.
Again, offense is not the right word to take here. I don't know why I would be offended about it. Who am I offended for? Myself, the Big Ten, UW? I don't know. Unclear.
I mean, if you wanted to
Indianapolis?
Say it is much closer to an SEC school than...
That's what I'm saying, yes. It is marked as SEC country. The people of St. Louis view themselves as being an SEC country. Anyways, the Huskies have been inspired by goalkeeper Mia Hammett, whose battle against stage 4 SMARCB1 deficient kidney cancer continues. Terrific season for UW women's soccer when they hope to keep rolling on Thursday towards a Big Ten tournament title.
I will say, I'm assuming Bloomington is the closest Big Ten city to St. Louis. Columbia, Missouri, right? That's where Missouri is?
It's actually further.
Not that much closer.
Okay, it is closer, though.
I mean, it's 125 miles to Columbia, and it is 225 miles to Bloomington.
So what you're telling me once again is that St. Louis is Conference USA territory. Hashtag Arc Madness. All right, congrats to Cal Raleigh and Dan Wilson, finalists for AL MVP and Manager of the Year, respectively. I believe those are going to be announced next week. We have the finalists now. And lastly, Something we haven't talked about for a while. Something that's unusual to talk about when it's
hydroplane
this.
Racing. Oh, it is hydroplane racing.
It is hydroplane racing. Welcome
oh,
back.
I'd love to see it.
To seven-time High Points champion Jimmy Shane, who will be returning to H1 in the 2026 season with BWR Racing after retiring following the 2022 campaign, went out on top as a champion, was really the heir to Steve David as, you know, kind of the face of hydroplane racing for several years there. So it was a loss to, you know, have him step away from the sport at the height of his powers. And now he is back. I think a testament to at least this BWR team led by Tri-Cities native Bruce Ratchford being in a pretty good place financially. We'll see about, you know, where the rest of the sport is and the depth of teams, but also will be interesting to see who's being displaced. We did have a report that J. Michael Kelly re-signed with Strong Racing after winning the season finale in the San Diego
Bay
Fair.
Important report that we got.
But have not seen anything yet on Andrew Tate, who's driving for BWR and won the National High Points Championship this year. The other boat driver for BWR Racing this year was Dave Vilwalk, who, of course, won in the Tri-Cities, becoming the oldest unlimited driver to win a race. All right, with that, it is time to continue our search for Seattle's best cookie with our final quarterfinals matchup. To help us decide the last spot in the semifinals in our search for Seattle's best cookie, we are thrilled to welcome back to the pod third Pelton brother, Zach Jabal. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I just learned before we get there was an ad in Maple Valley, Washington. I feel like it was for real estate for former Washington State Cougar defensive end, Christo Bruce.
Oh,
who I
nice.
Think, if you recall, Katie danced with at a party. Is that correct? Or was that a basketball player?
I thought that was Ike Arebo, but I may be way off on my memory.
And I'm scrolling through election results here on, I don't want to mention their name, but an enemy website. King County Fire Protection District 47, Commissioner Position 2. I'm Christo Bruce, 144 votes, write-in, 6 votes. Looks like he is running unopposed in King County Fire Protection District 47 Commissioner Position 2. Congrats, I think. So, to
wait,
Christo
you're telling me he can't coug it?
Oh, no.
We will see if write-in. I mean, right now it's only 6. He only has 144. So
look, man, we've seen the Cougars lose bigger leads.
Yeah.
Wow. And Christo Bruce appears to be like a professional bodybuilder as well, in addition to all these other things he's doing.
He's probably going to protect from the fires personally by hand, by right. fighting away the fires.
Yeah,
and you know what? I would trust him.
There's a reason you didn't vote for write-in.
For the record, I do not vote in that district.
You're pretty close
anyway,
to it, though.
Let's talk about cookies.
Yeah.
Zach, obviously, we know your wine credentials, host of the Vine Pair podcast, but tell us a little bit about your cookie credentials.
That's a good place to start, I suppose. I mean, besides, I think, the sort of general precondition that I like to eat cookies,
mm-hmm.
That's a good start.
I would say that I have a lot of experience eating professionally made cookies. You know, it's kind of an occupational hazard when you work in the restaurant industry as long as I did. So I've had the opportunity to both, you know, for personal and professional reasons, taste a lot of cookies in my lifetime. You know, don't ask my doctor about that, please. But yeah, I think I bring, you know, a general level of familiarity with, you know, the main kind of templates of cookies and sort of, you know, I think like everyone brings to judging like this, a set of personal preferences, but also kind of an understanding of a broader rubric by which to judge cookies.
What are your personal preferences then? I mean, we haven't quite distilled the cookies into the same sort of, you know, I don't know, the quadrants that we often do on these,
right,
these sorts of searches, but there are certainly some stylistic differences in terms of size and softness and things of that nature.
Right. I think for me, the sort of three things that I thought about as I tasted the cookies for this, and also just was sort of thinking about what I was going to bring to bear on the judging, was to me a kind of three elements of a cookie that I really look for. One is textural contrast. And I think you guys have talked a lot about that, right? You need a mix of some degree of crispness on the outside with some degree of moistness or softness or some sort of, you know, kind of chew to the cookie. The second is, I think you need a little bit of both complexity of flavor and, to me, some kind of flavor contrast. And so I think one note cookies tend to me to be the kind of thing where like it's fine, but that's like the realm of Girl Scout cookies. Like they're good, but you just kind of would not want to really linger on them. They're the thing you eat while you're like doing something else. And to me, like a really good cookie is the one where you're like, wow, this kind of demands my full attention, or at least most of my attention while I'm eating it. And then I think the last piece, and this is maybe the hardest thing, and in particular with the sort of two bakeries that I visited, you know, to what extent are you looking at playing it safe versus taking chances? And I don't even know, you know, maybe we'll discuss this. I don't even know that I think one is inherently right and then one is inherently wrong. But I think something that, you know, in the cookies that you guys have discussed already, the ones that I tried and a lot of the other ones out there, there is sort of a tension there, right? Of what is kind of sort of sticking with established forms versus, you know, trying something new.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that definitely has been, and I think as we get into the finals, you know, like into the semifinals and finals, this may be going to be an even more important consideration, I would say, particularly on this, so you're in the bakery side of the bracket,
right?
Here as we do Chicorina Bake Shop and Cafe against Volunteer Park Pantry Cafe and Pantry.
And I want to just note how thorough of an answer you gave about that.
It was
having a professional podcaster on is very nice. It's much more professional than Katie, say, who was just like, this one was good. Or right. She remembered that cookie. So I'm impressed by that. But I think you did actually, you kind of hit on all of the key points that we talk about with the cookies. And the piece about the creativity is, I think it comes down to also like, is this a good cookie? You know what right. I mean? Like the playing it safe, but not just being out of the box for out of the box sake, where you're sacrificing some of the flavor profile, but at the same time having something where, like you mentioned, like a Girl's Duck cookie, you know, it's not just like run of the mill, this is fine. And I do think we're going to have some of those conversations in the next round in particular, because there are a lot of cookies that have, they are different ends of the spectrum, but I'm not sure how complex the flavors are. And that's going to be one that I think is going to be a serious conversation. But it also reminds me of the conversation we had of the Ben's bread versus Saint bread, which I think I was on the losing side of, if I recall correctly. And
so
the Saint bread cookie to me kind of had that perfect mixture of it's outside of the box, but also it's just a really fucking good cookie. And that's what made it kind of like a special cookie, which these two, I think, are that we're going to be talking about today. One of them in Chicorina definitely is pushing some of those boundaries as well. And I think this is probably, given that we're on the bakery side of it, the ones that are the closest to that rather than one note cookies. So had you been to either of these places before?
I've been to Volunteer Park Pantry and Cafe a number of times in sort of several different iterations that it's existed in, not necessarily specifically for cookies, but I used to live not super far away. And so I would go have lunch there on occasion. And it was kind of one of those spots that, you know, always kind of appreciated that it had, you know, good baked goods, you know, salad, sandwiches, that kind of stuff, and a nice vibe. I had never been to Chicorina before. And in fact, as Kevin knows, I had, multiple trips to the Chicorina storefront before I was actually able to buy any cookies because, you know, they have relatively limited hours. Actually, relative is probably too much of a qualifier. They have quite limited hours. And I had misread when their hours were the first time. And so I showed up after they were closed. And so I had to go back the next day, which, you know, happy to do for the sake of cookies.
I admire the commitment.
Yeah. Well, you know, I said I would.
Okay. So which cookies did you have at these two locations?
Where do you want to start? You tell me.
Let's start with Volunteer Park.
Sure. So at Volunteer Park Cafe, I had, let's see here, I've got my notes out in front of me. So I had the Funfetti, which is, you know, kind of what you would imagine, sort of a sugar cookie, a little bigger than that, maybe with, essentially rainbow sprinkles in it. And then had the chai shortbread. Kind of that classic, sort of shortbread style, but with chai spices sort of in there. And then I had the buckwheat chocolate, which was an interesting cookie about which I will have more to say.
Yeah, I think that's sort of their flagship cookie. I believe that's the one that was ranked when the Infatuation did their list of Seattle's best chocolate chip cookies and left out Hello Robin. So we had that in the Funfetti. We did not do the chai shortbread.
Right. And I will say too, so the Volunteer Park Cafe cookies I had with my kids, we did a little cookie taste off. Their vote will not matter. They're minors, but it was interesting to hear what they had to think. And actually, interestingly, the three of us all kind of agreed. So actually maybe their vote does count. I don't know. And then at Sugarina, I had the honey snickerdoodle, the masala oatmeal, and then the chocolate chunk. I think a pretty decent cross section of kind of what they offer.
A representative sample. Yeah, the chocolate chunk is their signature, I would say. Well, I mean, I guess you can debate that, because the one we did not have this time but did have in the past was the Burberry caramel, right, which is really kind of outside the box, I would say.
I was sad that they didn't have that available when I went there. So
they were out when we went too. So we didn't try that this time, but we had the chocolate chunk, the honey snickerdoodle. And I'm not totally sure what the third one was, but it might have been the masala oatmeal. Mm-hmm. So
cool.
Which did have like a little bit of that spice profile, right, similar to the Burberry chocolate, to Burberry caramel.
So I'm going to, if it's okay with you guys, I'm going to start with kind of my thoughts on Sugarina. And then maybe we can talk about that, and then Volunteer Park Cafe. Not that it's my podcast, but I'm just gonna throw that out there.
Yeah.
So, I thought so. The honey snickerdoodle was interesting. I thought, you know, kind of an interesting take on it. You know, a pretty classic flavor profile. Definitely could get some of the honey note in there. It had a nice texture to it. It was not overly crunchy, which I think sometimes you get with a snickerdoodle. It can get a little dried out. And, you know, maybe if anything, it could have used a touch more cinnamon, but I think was nicely balanced. The masala oatmeal was really intriguing to me. Like, I think I love masala as a flavor. I thought bringing that into a cookie was interesting, and doing it kind of in that style of cookie, an oatmeal cookie. I think if anything, to me, like, I am a person who likes like oatmeal raisin cookie, and I think the cookie could have used some kind of dried fruit. Doesn't have to be raisins, obviously. Maybe another fruit would have made more sense, but just to bring there, I think you kind of lacked a little moisture in the cookie. Like, it was, you know, oatmeal cookies kind of can do that too, right? They just, it's oatmeal, right? Like, it kind of dries out naturally. And so I think it could have stood to have a little bit more of that, but I thought it had really nice flavor. And then I think the chocolate chunk to me was like, it was a really good chocolate chip cookie. I don't think any part of it to me was like, oh my God, like, stand up, take notice in particular. I thought, you know, a good amount of chocolate in the cookie. Again, like, good amount of, you know, kind of balance between crispiness and moistness, you know, had touch of salt to it, but not over the top. But I kind of just was like, yeah, this is a really good chocolate chip cookie, which I think, like, from having listened to how you guys have talked about all these places, that is a common refrain, right? Like, yeah, it's really good. Is it something that, you know, kind of takes that next step? I don't particularly think so.
Interesting. I feel like I was higher on the chocolate chip cookie. Tristan, where were you at on it?
It's so hard, because sometimes when I basically handed a box by Kevin, right, and it's like there's a bag and a box underneath it, and some of them are crumbled. So I wish that I was able to break it down as thoroughly as you were with those notes. And I think for the next round, it's going to be a little bit more of that, of like, you know, hitting both these places and really analyzing it. But the chocolate chip to me, I thought was actually the standout cookie for them, with the chunks in it, right, and the pieces that were spread throughout. I was kind of like, I feel like it is one of the better chocolate chip cookies that we've had on the search in general. And especially because it is more of that straightforward chocolate chip cookie. And a lot of places that we've been to don't even necessarily do that as well. But I think the profile of it, like the bakery style, I probably even prefer it maybe to treat somebody like that and the type of chocolate chip cookie that they do and the complexity of the flavor.
Yeah, I think the thing that go ahead, Kevin.
To me, I think the texture was the platonic ideal of what I'm looking for in a chocolate chip cookie. That's what I'd say about the Chicorina chocolate chip.
Yeah, and I think it has, like, there's an admirable amount of restraint to it. I think, like, that's something that's nice. Like, again, it's not over the top sweet. It's not so full of chocolate that it kind of doesn't hold together. I think that's something that you see in some, I think there's some of this tendency to kind of, like, you know, kind of take things to an extreme. And I thought it was nicely, it was, you know, it was a cookie, it was an indulgence, but it wasn't, yeah, you know, over the top.
Okay. What about Volunteer Park Cafe?
So I think for Volunteer Park Cafe, like, the kids did not like the chai shortbread, and it was fine. I mean, I didn't love it either. It's not
chai is not the most child flavor also, but
right. And shortbread, like, I like, my stepdad, like, lives in, like, swears by shortbread. I to me, it's never been like, when I want a cookie, that's never really what I tend to reach for. So in that standpoint, I was like, you know, okay, cool, this is interesting. The Fanfetti was good, you know, it was a sugar cookie with some extra, you know, pizzazz. But I don't think it necessarily was something that I was, I mean, again, I'm not a big sprinkles person. My kids liked it, maybe unsurprisingly as well. But I will say, to me, the showstopper of this entire round was the buckwheat chocolate. And I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I was not sure kind of how to come to this cookie and what to do. And I will say, like, I feel like I channeled Tristan while I was my first encounter with this cookie, because I did something that I would not normally do, which is like sat in my car and like destroyed one of the two cookies before I even drove away. And to me, like, the thing that made this cookie so spectacular to me is, you know, I said before that you want this kind of balance, this, you know, this kind of different elements in the cookie. And to me, this one, among very few kind of cookies that I've ever had, I feel like really brought, there's obviously sweetness from the chocolate, there's saltiness in there, there's a sort of bitterness and tanginess that the buckwheat brings, which I think is a really interesting note. And again, I can see someone coming to this cookie and being like, you know what, it's like a little too intense in some ways, because of all of those different flavors going on. But to me, the only downside I could say to it is, like, it is just an inherently buckwheat problem. It's like a little grainy. Like, there's just a kind of textural note to it that maybe if you're like, I want that kind of like buttery smoothness of a classic, like, flour, you know, classic chocolate chip cookie, it's not going to quite hit that. But to me, that was more than made up for by the fact that it just brought a dimension to a chocolate chip cookie that I had honestly never had. And now I'm like, well, I can't go back to just like a standard chocolate chip cookie. I mean, I'll manage, but like, I have continued to think about that cookie since.
I totally agree with you. And I also thought the sprinkles were great as well. Like the Funfetti, I thought they were pretty strong. And it was one of those moments where it was kind of like, I had to ask Kevin, I was like, which was which of these cookies? Because there was one that really stood out. And I was like, that is, to me, that is going to be the strongest cookie. And I had to get clarity on which it was. I think it's pretty close to this group of cookies is very similar to the Saint Bread and Bed's Bread, obviously being bakeries, all of them. I think that those three cookies, basically the Volunteer Park, the Bench Bread, and the Saint Bread chocolate chip cookies, are all very, very strong and all have their own kind of merits in that same way, where it's like it has the complexity of flavor. It's not too sugary. It's not too buttery, you know, because on the other side of the spectrum, we have Treat, which is all like very much sugar heavy, and Hello Robin, which is butter heavy. And I think the bakery cookies kind of have found, and this is not even saying I prefer them over another, but the basically like the roundness of those flavors, the yin and the yang of kind of all the things plus the new elements of it. So I'm going to give a guess here, but start us off with your pick in this round, Zach.
Well, you made me think of something too that I wanted to note here, which is, I think the thing that maybe that I'm trying to say about this buckwheat chocolate cookie is that it's maybe one of the few times where I've had a cookie and been like, this feels like a not a meal exactly, but like this is like a food stuff, not just a treat, I guess. And again, your mileage may vary on how that, if that's the experience you want from a cookie, but it was somewhat, you know, like revelatory to me, except in the sense that it still hit all of the cookie notes. Like, it wasn't like, I'm not like, you know, like the some of the other ones, you know, like they try shortbread, I'm kind of like, okay, like, you know, I'm like why am I going half measures here? Like, I want a cookie. But yeah, but that one to me was just like, wow, there's something going on here that I could not have expected. And so, yeah, I mean, I think to me, I think in a way, like the offerings from Chicorina kind of across the board, maybe a touch like higher collectively, or like the highs or the lows were, what am I trying to say? Like, the floor is higher, but maybe the ceiling is lower. And to me, I think in the end, I'm like, if I were to go back and get one of these cookies, and I will, I know exactly where I'm going, and that's Volunteer Park Cafe. So that's kind of where I stand on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair rubric to use, because I mean, definitely this is one of the things that we often talk about is, like, you know, back in the I guess we haven't done pizza, but like burgers, like, well, do you just get a plain cheeseburger at every of these places? It's like, no, we get whatever their best thing is, and that's what we're judging it by. And cookies are a little different because you're probably not ordering two or three different burgers, but it is possible to do that with cookies. But where I differ is I think of the chocolate chip cookies, Chicorina was the clear winner to me. And then I also liked them on the undercard, as you did as well. So Chicorina gets my vote here, and that leaves it to Tristan to decide.
I,
the last spot in the semifinals.
I think Chicharito is, to me, the biggest revelation of this entire search. It was the one that we didn't know that much about going into the search, and none of us had ever been to. It's still relatively brand new, right, as far as at least a brick-and-mortar location. And it was the one when we first went there, I was like, this is the type of cookie that I was impressed with, because most of the new places we went to, I was kind of like, they're fine, right? Like, they were just like, this is a cookie, you know? And Chicharito was the one that actually went out. I went there. I was surprised by it. I was excited by it. But then when it was there and I had this box of the two different types of cookies with each other, there was one that you just have to go to what you gravitate towards. And literally, when you have a box of five cookies and there's one half of those cookies that you prefer eating over the others, then the other half can't be Seattle's best cookie. And right. To me, Volunteer Park Cafe and Pantry was a pretty clear favorite, just taste buds wise. Of I was there and I was eating those, finishing all of those cookies. And I think Chicharito is a very, very strong candidate, but Volunteer Park Cafe and Pantry is, it's at another level. And I'm excited for you also to have had that experience with the buckwheat cookie, because that's kind of the goal of the search, is
right. To
go out and find something where it is like, okay, this is special. You know, this is more than just, you know, we talked about the basically Pelton Cast P system of, are you willing to travel for this? And there's some cookies that you're willing to travel for. And it sounds like this is one of those types of cookies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to me, like, that is one of the things that's been fun about occasionally being able to assist in this and or eat along with, is, you know, there are things that I have tried that I absolutely you just wouldn't have for whatever set of reasons, because they're not in my neighborhood, or, you know, it's not necessarily like, you know, a thing that I'm going out and seeking out. But, you know, my kids too were like, you know, they didn't exactly say this, but like, you could tell on their faces, like, their response to that buckwheat chocolate cookie was like, holy shit, this is really good. And, you know, my kids eat pretty well, all told. So like, that was, you know, something that I felt the same way, but I definitely, you know, took note of that also.
I see, hear what you're saying. The real winner of the search for Seattle's best cookie is the cookies we ate along the way.
Isn't it always?
I mean, it's us getting the chance to eat a lot of cookies also.
Right.
I'm happy that you're on the wrong side of it, Kevin.
It's mostly you, because I bring you cookies and you don't even have to travel a great distances to get them.
Sometimes.
You did go to Chicharito the first time, which, like, when I went there, I was like, oh, that's where that is? It's, you know, I did not realize that it was so close to Newmouse. I had no idea. Like, I've been down there 1,000 times and somehow had not realized it. I mean, not that it's been there most of those times.
I'm curious, because it didn't end up being a deciding factor, but I am curious to what extent, like, I was thinking about this, like, at what point do you get to, like, the way you guys kind of weighed in on Flower Box with donuts, where, like, the limited hours kind of make it hard to say, like, you know, to me, there is a point where you're like, you know, if the Chicharito cookies had been so clearly better, that would not have dissuaded me from picking them at all. I think if it had been a tie, I would have probably leaned towards the place that's, like, open every day with consistent hours, where it's like, because again, I think you guys have talked about this before. You think of this as an actual recommendation. And in a way, if the recommendation is like, well, you got to check the website and hope they're open, and then, like, who knows? That's, like, to me, a little bit of a demerit, even if, you know, I don't think it should stop you from going to Chicharito. Just check the website, please. don't do what I did.
Kind of the problem that we have with this search overall, because, like, Met Market, I'm allergic to the, you know, to the cookie at Met Market, so that can't be included. And I do suspect that that probably would be a legit competitor with it. So there are a couple of issues with the bracket overall. But we did that with Quick Pack Food Mart and the fried chicken search, where it's like, they don't have chicken thighs most of the time. All of the chicken is good, but the chicken thigh is the best. So you have to call ahead.
Yeah.
And be like, I mean, it's partially a feature of it, that it's kind of like, you have to be a little bit into get this fully. But if you're talking to somebody casually, like, I'm probably still going to recommend going to cookies for, no pun intended, to go to cookies for chicken, because it's just so much easier as far as a recommendation goes. But if it's somebody where it's like, hey, this is the real deal here, the same with Flower Box, where it's like, if you want the actual best donut in Seattle, be prepared to wait, but this is it. So it's almost like there's like two winners in each one, you know, where it's kind of like and I think it'll end up being that way with cookies as well, just because of the Met Market piece too, of like, there are a lot of people out there who feel very, very strongly about the cookie. It's just been difficult to include in this. So
yeah,
almost every search has two winners.
And you're only related to at least one of them.
Two if you count by marriage.
Right. Fair enough. Yeah. It's true. It's the thing that brought you guys together. How could it not be on the bracket, or how could it not get some sort of recognition?
It does deserve it. It also like takes some of the bias out of it if we don't officially consider it for
it's Seattle's not quite best, Pagliacci status, but it's close.
Seattle's best the cookie is the cookie at Met Market. But yeah, it'd be pretty insulting. What you said at the beginning there, it'd be pretty insulting to my food taste if you were like, this isn't a serious competitor for Seattle's best cookie, when I think it probably is. So
I mean, we'll have to have that conversation at the end, whatever wins. And then basically, you know, like you can go head to head of whatever wins the cookie search versus we can have that conversation at the end.
I think if anything, the only issue I have with the cookie is it's too big, which is like not really a complaint, but it's a big cookie. Like you get sharing. Your money's worth.
I feel like that's actually kind of a factor, though, because to me, Hello Robin's a much smaller cookie than almost anything else that we're talking about. Right.
Chicorinas are pretty modestly sized.
Well, anything left in the bracket.
Yeah. I think both of them today had pretty, like, what I would call, like, standard bakery-sized cookie. Like, neither was remarkably large or small, so, no.
And I think Hello Robin's, like, it's a pretty small cookie. You know, when you get them, you're kind of like, but at the same time, I can eat five of those cookies. And it's almost like, to me, again, in drinking days, there is a value in drinking six Rainiers versus drinking two IPAs sometimes.
Right.
So it's a little bit of a difficult thing to balance of what is better than the other, because it depends on the situation and what you're looking for. But have we talked grocery store cookies? I feel like we haven't done
the Safeway cookie discussion. No.
I feel like we haven't done the like extraneous other cookies. We haven't done the national cookie conversation. And I am thinking now that we have the bracket set, it's now time to start talking about, we have to have one episode at least where we talk about Safeway cookies, which are actually shockingly good Safeway cookies. And I think we need to talk about Crumbl and sort of the national cookie craze cookies.
Yeah, that's a good point. To revisit the bracket for the listener, in case you haven't been scoring along, on the final, on the bakery side, we now have Ben's Bread versus Volunteer Park Cafe and Pantry. And then on the cookiterie side, we have Hello Robin versus Treat is the two semifinalists. So those are your final four. That is now set. Yeah, I agree that there's more cookie investigation to happen, but what an amazing outcome.
Wow.
So thanks again to Zach.
I never saw it coming. I told you that it was going to be a landslide, though, when we went into this. And I feel like the final four that we have set are really, really strong final four, whatever they may be.
All right. With that, it is time for, I have down here, your favorite segment. What?
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariner's hot takes coming at you.
Take a look at any metric you would use to judge quarterback play. PFF grade, QBR, EPA per play, EPA plus CPOE composite. And there's one name at the top of every single list. Samuel Richard Darnold. And we can all agree on the fact that the NFL is the highest level of American football played in the world. And that Sam Darnold is the best quarterback in the best league in the entire world. Therefore, of the 8.142 billion people on Earth, Sam motherfucking Darnold is the best quarterback among them. And look, I'm not saying this is going to last for the rest of the year. No. I'm saying this is going to last for the rest of his playing career. Sam Darnold is the former number three pick in the draft, coming off a 14-3 season, whose only knock on him from the knocking types was his ability to avoid sacks. And he currently has less sack yards lost than his former teammate, JJ McCarthy, has in three games. He has started every game and is 34th in the league in the stat. What is more likely sounding here? The third pick in the draft struggled with the Jets, and his OC not even good enough for Tavares Jackson, Jeremy Bates. The Panthers, who somehow also weren't happy with Baker Mayfield, MVP candidate, and settled on, I shit you not, this happened, PJ Walker as their starting quarterback. Or maybe this was an absolute diamond in the rough waiting to be discovered by John from the top rope, has the championship belt because this John Schneider knows how to win the big one, Schneider. And the Seahawks, 2 years after moving on from Pete Carroll, managed to get the quarterback of Pete Carroll's dreams. A big-armed, gunslinging quarterback who feels very comfortable in play action, can game manage when he needs to, and throws a beautiful deep ball. Hope you're having fun with our leftovers in Vegas, Pete, because John has done it again. Found the greatest steal at the most important position. He has to be, because Sam Darnold is the best quarterback in the world.
I like that you looked up the population of the world.
You don't think I just came up with that off the dome?
Okay. 2-3 decimal points or in the millions places, I suppose, if they actually. I had to look up
the entire population to let us know how many of those nerds are worse at quarterback than Sam Darnold.
It's all true. So when Daniel Jones had Sunday, there definitely was like that moment of, ooh, is this coming for Sam Darnold? But I do think there is a substantial difference in terms of, like, yes, Sam Darnold had two down games at the end of last season with the Vikings, but he also, like, had a full season where he was an average or better NFL starting quarterback. And as much as he probably did benefit from Kevin O'Connell's scheme and Justin Jefferson, we are seeing this season that those are not enough to lead anyone to above average quarterback play. And while J.J. McCarthy, kudos to him for getting the win on Sunday, a win that frankly helped out your Seattle Seahawks at the top of the NFC, it was not because of his dominant quarterback play that the Vikings won that game against Detroit. So, and then, you know, again, we have an increasing sample of Sam Darnold playing really well for the Seahawks. There are these occasional lapses into turnover caliber play. We saw one of those on Sunday night, but overall you look at kind of the underlying PFF metrics and turnover worthy throws, you know, versus turnover worthy plays versus big time throws. And that's one of those categories where he continues to be at the top of the league. Like, again, he's been put in awesome situations. He had open receivers to throw to all over the place on Sunday, but he was also making big time throws. The underlying process here is sound. There's always going to be that concern until Sam Darnold goes and does it in the playoffs, but I don't think he could do just about anything else during the regular season to prove himself.
Wow, there we go.
Not
you've been Darnold world also.
My verdict is that take is not hot enough.
Wow. Hello.
Needs to be Sam Darnold should be the greatest quarterback in Seahawks history. But, you know, maybe save that for a later date. Okay. Where do you want to talk about the rest of this game?
Yeah, I do.
let's start with, you said that the Seahawks are too good. They're actually boring.
I think that is fair. Don't you? Have the Seahawks played a fun game since the Tampa Bay game? It wasn't that many games ago, but were you in the United States? How about this? When that Tampa Bay game happened?
I was, yes. I don't believe we had. Certainly, we were not outside of American airspace by the time that game ended, but I believe we were still on the tarmac. I don't think we had taken off.
That was when you were leaving.
Yeah. Okay, wasn't when we were coming back. We came back before the Houston game. I mean, my thought about Sunday night was, this is what the Houston game would have looked like if the Seahawks hadn't made the number of, like, boneheaded mistakes that they did to keep Houston in that game. There wasn't a pass attempt by a receiver at any point during the Washington game that could be intercepted.
I don't know what I was doing during this Arizona game, but I literally have no recollection of that game at all.
I mean, it was an exciting game, but yeah, that was obviously before the Tampa Bay game. I mean, they have played, you know, the Pittsburgh game. I don't know if I would go so far as to say that that was, like, uninteresting because of the fact that it was lopsided, but New Orleans, to Houston, even though the score was actually quite
close. Oh, okay. The Arizona game is the Thursday night game. That's why I don't remember. And I was at Marco's birthday the whole time.
That's right. Yes.
Yes. So I was like, what? Literally, what happened? But honestly, they've had their problem has been in a couple of these games is just letting people hang around for a second too long. The Arizona one being one of them, right? That one. Same with Houston.
There was
Arizona was in it in that game, but Houston was never actually in it in that game.
There has been a certain difficulty closing out games in terms of running the ball late. And one good way to solve that problem is to lead the opponent by multiple touchdowns. So it really, truly does not matter at all.
But some of those games also were the defense at nowhere near full strength, right? When the Seahawks went to 3-1 against the Cardinals, I mean, how much of the defense was out during that game? I guess Spoon was playing.
I think it was more the Tampa Bay game where those injuries really got cascaded together.
I think it's a fine place to be, though, right now. We don't need to have interesting football games at the moment. I am fine with this. We could play an interesting game against the Rams. We could play interesting games in the playoffs.
Exactly. What's exciting about this game is not that it was a close finish or that we needed to be watching for the fourth quarter. And we should make sure to say here, thoughts with Jaden Daniels. Not yet clear necessarily that this injury is season ending for him, which is good to hear given how grotesque it looked on the field. Sometimes things are not as good or as bad as they look. But it was a game where you didn't need to pay attention in the fourth quarter. But the exciting thing about it is not what it meant for this game against Washington on a Sunday night. It's what it means for the future that the Seahawks are capable of playing at that level.
What I think that you had talked about on the preview last weekend about how bad Washington was against early down passing.
Ooh, buddy.
And I mean, the Seahawks did it in every down, right? Early down passing in particular, what they did in this game to Washington. I mean, they made their defense look foolish across basically the entire game and just how easily they did it and how many different ways they did it. I mean, obviously, the completions that Darnold had in a row. And sometimes when you see those stats, it's like, oh, they're 16 for 16, but it's for 130 yards, right?
That was
Darnold
not this.
Had yardage without throwing an incompletion in there. And some of those weren't as easy as, they could have been. Even the touchdown, right? The touchdown to Arroyo was not an easy throw and an easy catch. He probably had an easier one that he could have taken on the other side of the field. But the way that Darnold is reading the field right now is at an incredibly high level. And what he's doing, but also the run game, I think the line is starting to figure it out. I wasn't as surprised that there wasn't a move made on the offensive line today at the trade deadline as maybe after the game, people were go find a guard. And I'm like, I think they're figuring it out. And I don't know what the PFF grades are going to say. It's funny because the stats aren't incredible, but just watching it, it felt like this was the best offensive line game of the season. And even some of the holes that they had, for the running backs, the Ken Walker stat line isn't amazing. The Charbonnet stat line isn't good, really. But some of the holes that they had in this game, it was all because of the line, right? It wasn't necessarily about Ken Walker did something amazing in this. So they're all coming together as a unit and getting better. And the pass protection's been great. Clint Kubiak, I mean, it's easy to, he was the one piece that I was skeptical about coming into the season was the year in New Orleans last year. And everybody kept pointing to that early season in New Orleans. And it's like, well, if it's like this, and I'm like, yeah, but they also played the other 15 games. But we're kind of seeing the beginning of the New Orleans season spread out through an entire season so far. And God willing, Sam Darnold's health right now, what the Seahawks have been capable of is pretty incredible at this point. And the way that they have teams kind of on their toes, Clint is cooking right now. Clint called, a basically flawless game. They took their foot off the gas in the second half, but let's say this: Clint called a flawless first half, and that was more than enough.
I think towards the greater long-term goal, he called a perfectly fine second half as well.
Yeah, it's not even an insult. I'm just saying, they didn't score on every single possession.
Right.
But
they averaged 0.945 expected points added per play on first and second down passes, 0.73 on third and fourth down passes, which I don't know if there was a fourth down. So they were good at all of it, but extraordinarily good first and second down. I mean, adding a point per play is just truly preposterous. And the success that they did have in the early game going with the run game, I think, forced Washington to recommit to defending that even more. And, you know, just opened up all sorts of things for the Seahawks passing attack. I mean, what I thought about Clint Kubiak in the preseason is, you know, I said it, like, if it's so good to have this offense that marries the run and the pass, et cetera, like, why doesn't everyone do it? And now I'm legitimately asking, why doesn't everyone do it?
Yeah.
And hoping they don't for at least like another year in terms of hiring Clint Kubiak as a head coach, because who knows how many more Kubiak sons there are out there.
I mean, I guess my answer to that question is it has to be a combination of, we saw it with New Orleans, right? It doesn't always work. You have to have the line. You have to have the receivers. You have to have the quarterback play. And this team, I was the most critical of John Schneider. I will give John Schneider credit that with these drafts that he's put together and the Darnold signing, I thought that this was going to be a bridge team. But what we are seeing right now is this is going to be the foundation of the next Seahawks Super Bowl team. And it's probably going to be this season. But
I would not go so far as to say probably, but it could be this season.
There was in the ESPN trade grades, I think there are limitations to the ESPN FPI or whatever they're using for those metrics. Seeing that they had the Colts with an 11% chance to win the Super Bowl and the Seahawks with a 5% chance to win the Super Bowl. And I was just like, the path that the AFC, any AFC team has to take to get to the Super Bowl is so much harder than any NFC team. Right? Those same Colts have to be good enough and better than the Chiefs and the Bills to get there. And not even to mention, I know it's aren't necessarily that good statistically, but like the avenues are so much harder. The NFC is kind of cleared. If the Seahawks can conquer the Rams, which we'll see in a couple weeks, the NFC is looking like the kind of place that a team like the Seahawks can win.
I don't know if I would go so far as to say it cleared, but I would say that, yeah, I mean, there is no single team. There's a variety of compelling teams because, you know, there are, I guess, four teams with two losses or fewer. One of those teams did win the Super Bowl last year. There's also a 5-3 team that did have the NFC's best record last year and still has the conference's third best point differential, that being the Lions. So
lost to the Vikings. Like the Seahawks don't have bad losses in there either. A lot of these teams, they don't even have close games necessarily. Like the Cardinals one that they kept close, but I mean, DVOA is telling the story of the season right now.
Well, it is interesting that DVO is so different than EPA, as Aaron Schatz wrote about in that write-up. Special teams being one factor there, and another factor being that basically both the Seahawks offense and the Seahawks defense grade better in terms of their first and second down performance by DVOA, the way that they're scoring plays, than EPA the way that it is. So, you know, what that actually means is tough to say. What Aaron Schatz said was his conclusion is he thinks they are the best team in the NFL, but probably not the historically great, one of the
not
greatest,
the fourth best team through this point in NFL history.
Through eight games in NFL history that DVOA shows them as being. So,
go ahead.
You want to talk big picture for a second here?
I have one more comparison here. And the thing that I think the Seahawks team reminds me of is not an NFL team. And the way that they are such a machine.
Weirdly,
right,
it is
now,
the 2025 Seattle Mariners.
Sam Darnold is Cal Raleigh. no, what they remind me of is a college program. In the way that in the NFL, it is not that easy to have all three parts of the game be this dominant and to beat teams as dominantly as they're beating them. And even if, let's say, a college team, right, if you're Ohio State or something, let's say that you lose a game, right? It's almost always because of randomness. It's almost never because of when you get to one of those machine-level college teams. It's almost never because you got outplayed in that game. And the Seahawks have not been outplayed in a single game this season. The closest might be the 49ers in week one, where they were still figuring it out a little bit. But maybe we'll accept that one. But that they are this dominant on offense, this dominant on defense, this dominant on special teams, Sam Darnold is kind of like Julian Sain at this point.
Yeah, that's probably a fair comparison. I agree with that.
So that to me is what I was watching them in a way that it's not like every game you don't watch Ohio State and you're like, wow, that was so fun. You're like, that team destroyed this other team in every single capacity of the game. Offense, defense. And that's what Mike McDonald obviously had experience at Michigan, a program that was doing similar things with that very quarterback the Vikings chose over Sam Darnold. And that's what it reminds me of through this point of the season.
Yeah. With Jay Harbaugh as special teams coordinator there. So to transition here, the Seahawks did all this offensively without Cooper Kupp, who was a late add to the injury report, eventually scratched. Sounds like he may not be back. You know, IR potentially a possibility for him. Also played without Jake Bobo. They weren't missed in this one. JSN, eight catches and nine targets for 129 yards. Torrey Horton getting the start. Four catches, four targets, 48 yards. Pair of touchdowns really announced his presence to a national audience. And then a 60-yard touchdown to Cody White, which was pretty fun to see. But Seahawks still wanting to upgrade their receiver room, viewing themselves as contenders along your lines, traded a fourth and a fifth to New Orleans for the aforementioned wide receiver, Rashid Shaheed. Shaheed went undrafted out of Weber State in 2022, was an immediate contributor as a rookie with 488 yards, peaked at 48 catches and 75 targets for 719 yards and five touchdowns in 2023 when he was also chosen a Pro Bowler and All-Pro first team as a return specialist. He's returned two punts for touchdowns in his career, was third in punt return yards, fourth in kick return yards in 2023. Has this year been largely taken out of kick returns, just one all season. He played 76% of offensive snaps last season when Clint Kubiak was the Saints offensive coordinator, as you mentioned, 74% so far this season, is a full-time starter, even with them healthier, averaging just 11.3 yards per reception. That's down from 16.6 over his first 3 yards, but his catch rate is up to 67% after catching just 49% last season when it was a much more boom or bust style. And obviously he's been doing this with Tyler Shook and Spencer Rattler as his quarterbacks, very different from the best quarterback on all of planet Earth.
There we go. And system as well. I mean, his familiarity. Obviously, they felt like they needed another receiver, and Clint had familiarity with Rashid Shaheed. I understand that the price was a little bit higher than maybe we wanted of a fourth and a fifth, but I don't think it's hand-wringing level of concern for this one. And if it's a place that they felt like they needed depth, then that's great. They probably did need another receiver.
I think to go back to your point about the offensive line, one of the underrated things about offensive line play is the importance of continuity there. So bringing in a starter midseason from another team, I don't think it's as easy as, you know, it's not the Madden rating where the left guard you trade, or the PFF rating where the right guard you trade for has, you know, an 80 grade. And yep. Anthony Bradford has a 59 grade, and therefore you improve that much. I think there's a significant, you know, adjustment both to Clint Kubiak's scheme and to, you know, knowing the personnel around you operating as a unit and as an offensive line that makes that less appealing. And, you know, we also don't know sort of who was available, what that cost was going to be. I think Shaheed, given his experience with the Saints, given, you know, the way that receivers operate, much more of a plug and play option. I think my one concern here, like on the field, is I hope it doesn't take away from Torrey Horton's opportunities, because I think he is legitimately quite good. But, you know, particularly while Cooper Kupp is out, there's going to be plenty of opportunity for both of those guys to go around.
I'm not super concerned about that. I mean, like, Cody White was on the field quite a bit on Sunday.
Right. I don't love giving up both a fourth and a fifth, because the Seahawks now have only a sixth in terms of day three of the NFL draft.
They're going to have to go find a pick next year. You know, they're going to have to move down in that first round and go find some picks there. But I think it's something that they are definitely capable of doing. Rashid Shaheed is a different type of receiver also than everybody else who's there in the room. I mean, they were looking for this with Marquez Valdes-Scantling. It didn't work out. And they're still looking for Rashid Shaheed to basically be that deep threat and open up the offense a little bit more. And there's stuff that Clint is obviously wanting to do or feeling like they can do with Shaheed. So I mean, you're going to talk about not trading any other players. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can say on Shaheed, like, it's the pure speed element. I do think he's not going to play 74% of snaps when Cooper Kupp is healthy with the Seahawks, and that probably frees him up to play a more important return role than he was with the Saints. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what kind of a factor he can be there. You know, so in to your point about him not being the Seahawks receivers, he's also like just a substantially better player than Marquez Valdes-Scantling, who was not nearly as important to the Saints offense when the two guys, those guys were both out there last year. So, you know, if your point is, oh, well, they went and got a Clint Kubiak guy before and look, they cut him in training camp, like that's a totally different story.
Yeah. I mean, he's also significantly younger as well.
Yes. So this is somebody who, despite being an unrestricted free agent this offseason, could be a part of the Seahawks long-term, or the play here could be to recoup some of that draft value in terms of compensatory picks.
Yes, we'll see. I mean, I just looking around at what the rest of the league did and the types of picks that were traded, I was thinking that the NFL trade deadline looked a little bit more like the NBA, looking a little bit more like the MLB. So that was kind of fun today. But
I mean, that's been coming over a period of time. But yeah, I mean, what the Jets did, it's hard to make the comparison between MLB because there's not the draft picks, but like the multiple first-round picks going out mid-season is very...
Oh, the Jets
NBA
were
style.
Massive winners today. You know, like the Jets were the biggest winner of the day by far. But seeing what the Colts did on the opposite, you know, on the other conference to try to shore up their odds, they basically, that was selling out your future, right? Like, that was going very, very far and committing to a player. And that's something that John Schneider has done in the past. A fourth and a fifth is not really a thing he's done necessarily. No. It's almost always been like a fifth, or it's been the massive haul. So this is kind of like he split the difference. It wasn't a steal. I was thinking of it closer to maybe like at the time we were a little skeptical about the Leonard Williams deal. And maybe it didn't look amazing right away. But now long term, Leonard Williams for a second looks like a very good deal for the Seahawks.
Yeah, I mean, that one's an interesting one because he did not have the immediate impact they hoped. They did not make the playoffs and gave up a much better second than they were expecting. But, you know, even though Leonard Williams, they didn't get a discount re-signing him, they probably did have an edge re-signing him because of the time that he'd spent on the locker room in the system that previous season. And that contract that he signed has aged tremendously well. So they'll have a choice to make with Shahid. I do think it's interesting, you know, if this is an implication that the Seahawks are more likely to try to collect comp picks this offseason, and that could be related to the decision to not trade Rick Woolen and Boye Mafe, both of whom, you know, can be free
agents
as well.
Has anybody talked about
trading
Boye Mafe aside from you, or are you the only one?
No, it's been out there. What are you talking about?
I mean, basically, to me, the last couple of weeks have been... I was not surprised at all that they didn't trade these players, and I would have been very surprised if they traded either. Like, Reek played a great game, probably played his best game of the year last Sunday against Washington. And you just need depth defensively. So if you're in the position that the Seahawks are in, those people in that building think this is a team that could compete for a Super Bowl, rightfully, right? If you think they're not aware of that DVOA, they're aware. They're not taking their foot off the pedal, but like the reality is they're viewing this as a season, not that they're going to try to do good enough or as a bridge year. This is the year for the Seahawks. And so you need as much depth as possible defensively. We saw how quickly in the secondary players can get injured. As far as edge rushers and on the defensive line, you just need as much depth as you humanly can. Boye Mafe has been a good player for the Seahawks. I'm not willing to just write Boye Mafe off. Rick Woolen has been a good player for the Seahawks. They're going to need both of those players for the rest of the season.
I mean, I think Reek's value was really obvious on Sunday, which is interesting because he started the game on the bench, not as part of their nickel formation, did play when they went to dime at times and just had one linebacker on the field. And then you have an amazing amount of secondary talent out there between Spoon, Iman Woori, Woolen. And of course, that was short lived with Josh Jobe suffering a concussion and putting Woolen back into the base lineup that the Seahawks typically use. I think he is like a difference making player. I don't think that Boye Mafe, particularly in the context of this scheme, is a difference making player. So that's why I would have been okay with them trading him and just, you know, figuring out who that replacement is going to be. But if they did see it as a downgrade, a considerable downgrade the rest of the season, then yeah, they probably shouldn't do it because they are in a Super Bowl window right now. And, you know, So my ESPN colleague Seth Waldron, do we say he gave it an A- for the Shahid trade?
No, I thought that was a good grade, though.
I was surprised it was that high, certainly. And I do think they benefited to a degree from the comparison to the Colts, because it's like, well, if the Colts did this, like, the Seahawks is kind of the NFC Colts in some ways. Like, it was a much more measured move, without question. And I know that, like, I've been there in terms of that sort of thing affecting, you know, how I frame things and how I grade things. He pointed out that the Seahawks have so much cap space in terms of arguing that maybe they are not going to, you know, get compensatory picks this offseason. A lot of that cap space is going to be devoted to re-signing their own guys next year. And that's something that that my ESPN colleague Brady Henderson cited is a reason that perhaps the Seahawks would trade Woolen or Mafe, because of the fact that they just, you know, are not going to potentially give bonuses to Charles Cross, who will be going to the last year of his rookie extent deal, JSN and Spoon, who will be going into the fourth years of theirs, and pay a bunch of a big signing bonus to Reek Woolen on top of that. They ultimately didn't do it, but you know, if you're letting all of those guys walk in free agency and maybe, you know, again, using that cap space to extend your players or to add a couple of guys via trade, then that could be a way that you end up recouping that draft value via comp picks. It's easier said than done, but it is an option.
I will also say the Boye Mafe is 2 weeks off leading the team, I think, in PFF grade. Against the Texans. So, like, this idea that Boye Mafe isn't contributing, I'm not sure if I buy either.
I mean, what percentage of snaps is he playing? I guess 59% is a pretty considerable amount. Okay.
You're way too down on Boye Mafe. And if this
I mean, I don't know. Maybe I like my edges to get a sack every once in a while. Like, he has zero sacks all season. I don't know. I don't think that's a controversial position.
Sure. I mean, like, it's sacks are not always the best way to judge a player as well.
I agree with that. Yes. That's undoubtedly true.
But, like, if you're only judging him based upon that, it's also he's part of a scheme.
And his advanced numbers are, I grant, better than that.
And we're just fine. You know what I mean? Like, the reality
but I guess
is,
what I'm
like,
seeing
do you have
is
complaints
that,
about the defense?
No, but I guess what I'm seeing is that Mike McDonald is able to develop these unheralded backups. It's, you know, Josh Jobe, the production that he's gotten out of him at corner. Ty Okada, the production that he's had replacing Julian Love at safety. Like, is there the ability to do that with another edge as well behind Boye Mafe? I think is
it's just
my question.
Not a thing you do midseason, though, when you don't need to.
Okay.
I mean, obviously they agreed as well. And like, what's the return?
And who knows,
is it
what
a
the
fifth round pick?
I mean, that's what I was thinking, is if it was better than a six. I mean, look, you know, we don't know what the offers were. We don't know a variety of things. One thing we also don't know is what Ernest Jones IV status is. And it is somewhat encouraging that they did not see the need to make a move for a middle linebacker or an off-ball linebacker after he left Sunday's game with a knee injury. Mike McDonald said they'd have more of an update on Wednesday, but that it does not look at this point like it's season ending. My last thing on last Sunday, I posted this on Blue Sky, but it didn't get a lot of attention there. The Seahawks 8.7 yards per play were the fourth best in a single game in franchise history. So not too shabby.
And I will say, okay, that was fourth best in franchise history. Granted, this is going to happen every time you're averaging that many yards per play, because you're probably going to be crushing teams when you are.
Actually, there was like evenly split between, there were two games where they were crushing teams and then two like shootouts. So let me go see if I can dig that list up.
But just that they punted, I think, three of their last four drives. And it was a real just like, you know, we're kind of just having fun out here at this point. Like, the game was over. Jaden Daniels had been injured. I think people were taking their foot off the gas quite a bit.
I guess there were three blowouts. The most yards per play was Arizona in 2014 at Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to
Sunday
remember.
Night.
A Sunday night? Was that it? I'm thinking of the DVOA Bowl where they dominated, but that wasn't this one. That was a season finale. This was
35-6.
Yeah, I don't. Ryan Lindley started, as he often does.
Oh. No, I think this was just a game. I don't think this is.
Oh, no, it was a Sunday night. You're right. Start time, okay. 8:30 p.m. So maybe this was that the DVOA Bowl? I don't know.
There's no way that Ryan Lindley started the DVOA Bowl.
Well, Arizona had already clinched
the
NFC West in the DVOA
good.
Bowl. Yeah,
we just beat the piss.
But this
out of
was,
them.
but this is game 15 and not 16. So I'm thrown by that. I need to go back and it happened before Christmas. So it's hard to imagine the Seahawks not ruining Christmas with their play.
This had to be the game. I mean, Marshawn had a 79-yard run where he jumped into the end zone, right?
Oh, yes.
That had to be that play.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And Luke Wilson, I forgot about that. Luke Wilson going for 139.
They beat Denver 41-16 in 1986, was also number three on this list. And then number two was at Detroit 2022, early in that season. Geno's first season as a starter when they won 48-45.
Yeah, I know. That game was very fun.
In a truly wild game.
That was one where I was like, well, we might be onto something, right? Because they'd beaten the Broncos. And then you're like, well, they beat the Broncos. Season's over. And then they had that game against the Lions. And it was like, well, it's the Lions before they were good. But it was definitely like, yeah, the offense might be good, though.
I'm trying to think. I think I was on my way to a sporty event at Lumen Field. So was this like a Sounders playoff? A Sounders match on October 2nd, 2022?
It was a day game.
Yeah, it was a morning game, but I remember like watching it at Paseo before going over there.
Russ also had a 55 yarder. They just had a lot of really. I will say, here's the difference, I guess. Cody White had the long play, but like they didn't have a ton of really big plays.
It was more about the consistency. Yeah, it was like every play somebody is open.
And this one included an 80-yarder for Luke Wilson, a 79-yarder for Marshawn, a 55-yard run for Russ, and a 49-yard pass to Doug Baldwin, which I don't remember the play, but I could picture it in my head right now. That's a little bit of a different way to get there. And I think what the Seahawks did on Sunday is probably a little bit more sustainable, too.
Now I'm seeing that the Sounders played away that day, so... I am confused.
Could it have been a storm game? No, November or September. Yeah, it could have been, right?
No, it was October 2nd, 2022.
Wait, what game were you talking about? The Lions one?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was in September.
No, you're thinking of the next year at Detroit.
Okay.
Which was lower scoring. That was the overtime win that I attended. So I know where I was for that one, but I'm trying to piece it together for this one. I got nothing. Maybe I watched it at your house, actually.
No, you didn't. I was at Ravensdale when that game happened. Anyway, this is definitely a more sustainable way to have a game like that without a bunch of just random big plays. So
great.
No notes on the team.
Should we talk about the Cardinals? I mean, there were lots of notes. We talked for a long time, but no
not
complaints.
Yeah.
Should we talk about the Cardinals?
Whew. I guess so.
Now that you remember their first matchup in Arizona earlier this season and how close it got at the end, that was part of a five-game losing streak for Arizona that they snapped Monday night with a 27-17 win at Dallas. In the wake of that game, on Tuesday, Jonathan Gannon announced that Jacoby Brissett will start on Sunday. He's made three starts in place of Kyler Murray, who's still recovering from a foot injury. But beyond the injury, Cardinals simply playing better offensively with Jacoby Brissett at the controls. They are 13th in offensive EPA per play in the last three games. They're also 13th in dropbacks. They were 20th and 15th, respectively, in Murray's five starts. Brissett is completing a career-high 65% of his attempts for 7.7 yards per attempt, as compared to a sickly 6 yards per attempt for Kyler Murray during his five starts. His sack rate is quite high. It's 10.4%, up from 9% with Murray. Cardinals have the 7th highest sack rate overall in the NFL, and the Seahawks sacked Murray 6 times when these teams played earlier this season. So this feels like a day that the front 7 could feast again. Brissett obviously doesn't bring the scrambling dimension that Kyler Murray does, but he's 12th in EPA plus CPOE composite this season. Murray is 20th. So all in all, it seemed like a fairly predictable and kind of desired outcome here among Cardinals fans.
Desired for the Cardinals. I mean, it's still a decision. Even if you say Jacoby Brissett's playing better right now, they are making a decision about the franchise by starting Jacoby Brissett in this game.
I mean, they are emphasizing that Murray is not ready.
Exactly. Kyler may come back and play later, but it's a little bit of like we are choosing to be starting Jacoby Brissett here. Kyler Murray is aware of this information, but things can change very, very quickly in the remainder of a football season. At the same time, if they go 3-6, thinks, you know, the Cardinals are the team as a byproduct of being in the NFC West. Maybe the non-conference schedule is not as hard, but they still have left most of the hardest non-conference games. Whereas the Seahawks have been through a lot of those. They still have the Jags at the Buccaneers, at the Texans. Who knows what the Bengals will look like. And then a bunch of NFC West teams. This could be the season for the Cardinals.
Yeah, I mean, they're in a tough spot given how good this division is. Marvin Harrison Jr. had one of his best games with a 7 catches in 10 targets for 96 yards on Monday and a touchdown. Not enough, nearly not enough for Tristan's fantasy team in a fabulous Pelton matchup on this weekend. You lost by the margin of one CeeDee Lamb catch, basically, in the fourth quarter. Harrison's averaging...
Do I have Javonte Williams in that league?
Yes.
It was the Javonte Williams fumble, right?
I guess it was the Javonte Williams fumble, although, you know, Dak would have thrown a touchdown pass had he not.
They would have kicked a field goal. What are you talking about?
What was this? Because they were still outside the two-minute warning?
Third and 12.
Okay, I don't know. I don't remember. I guess I don't remember exactly what
he might not have thrown the pick. I mean, it's revisionist history. But like, honestly, I think the game going longer might have been better for me at that point, especially if the Cardinals had to try to do anything or a chance of overtime. But if Dak doesn't throw the pick, it's probably apples to apples, the pick and the fumble. But like, literally, it was the margin of the Javonte Williams fumble. So cool.
Harrison is averaging an outstanding 9 yards per target in his second season. Like, his raw numbers are not great, but I feel like he is playing quite well. Trey McBride leads the team with 75 targets, 50% more than Harrison, but his 69% catch rate, 6.3 yards per target are both career lows for the 2024 Pro Bowler. Amari DeMarcado was the leading running back on Monday with 14 carries for 79 yards. Had just 8 carries all season before that, so that was kind of a perplexing change. But Bam Knight leads the team with 38 carries, but averaging just 3.4 yards per attempt. Michael Carter's at 2.8 with James Conner and Trey Benson both on IR. Benson is eligible to return this week. I've not yet seen an update there. Cardinals defense is number 10 in DVOA. They're pretty average across the board in terms of rushing and passing and EPA per play, but have faced a difficult schedule. They've faced 3 of the top 5 in offensive EPA, plus the Seahawks, who, as we've noted earlier, are much higher by DVOA. The one thing they have done well, opponents converting just 36% of third downs. That has been a weakness for the Seahawks at times. That's worth watching in this one. Not necessarily because of their pass rush. Josh Sweat has 7 sacks, Calais Campbell 5, but the Cardinals have just 5 other sacks combined, a pretty dramatic contrast to the depth of the Seahawks pass rush, despite the lack of Boye Mafe sacks.
And I think if you look back at that game that they played in, what was that, week 4? In week 4. The Seahawks didn't really play, they comfortably were leading this entire game, but they didn't really play their best game in it. There's almost nothing that really stands out from that one. Darnold was good, but he took a few sacks and he got pressured. Ken Walker was fine. JSN was fine. Across the board, the defense was pretty dominant until, and I think this was actually still a little bit, this was in the early season Seahawks phase, and the offense has turned it on even more since then. They've kind of put it together. The line's gotten a little bit better. Clint's figuring it out a little bit more. It was only a close game also as a byproduct of Jason Myers' missed field goal. This is going to be the last game that Jacoby Brissett starts before Kyler Murray is back as starting quarterback of the Cardinals. That is my bold prediction to you. What the Seahawks defense is going to do against Jacoby Brissett in this game, it's been nice, but this isn't the Cowboys anymore. And, you know, they're basically, Jacoby Brissett has some games littered with very good losses against what are probably some, like, ultimately kind of fraudulent defenses and better offenses, but it's the Colts, it's the Packers, it's the Cowboys. This is a different type of animal that they are coming to Seattle with the offense and the defense that the Seahawks have here. If the game wasn't actually as close as it should have been in Arizona with Kyler, like, I think Kyler is a better quarterback than Jacoby Brissett is. And I'm not convinced of any of these stats lasting long-term for this one. There's too much history and this defense is going to stifle them. They're healthy. They're in a good place. I have no concerns about this game at all.
No concerns about this game. Percentage chances of victory.
Do you have any?
I mean, first off, it's the Cardinals in Seattle. I inherently have concerns.
It's going to be another boring one. Not boring.
I know that I'm that confident. Do you know that Jacoby Brissett, according to Pro Football Reference, has the lowest interception rate in NFL history?
Great.
Kind of amazing. But yeah, I mean, look, he's, you know, a slightly above average quarterback. I mean, I actually am not convinced that Kyler Murray is better than that. Jacoby Brissett is not the answer at this stage of his career, but I don't know that Kyler Murray is either, I guess is what I'd say.
The line is Seahawks minus six, and it should be somewhere around 9.5 to 10, my opinion.
It'll be interesting to see if that moves over the course of the week.
I think Vegas is still not as on board with the Seahawks as they should be and are probably going to be longer term. It's a game they need to win and get to 7-2. And it's all about 2 weeks from now against the Rams, you know, going at LA Rams. That is the most important game of the season so far. And they've got to win this one. And I think they'll win it comfortably. It's like a, I don't know, 78% chance of victory, 82. I'm going to go 82. 82% chance of victory. That's too high. No, I'm going to go 78%.
Okay, now we're roughly in the same ballpark. I mean, I think that would be a nice thing if this were a lopsided game, is if the Seahawks could, you know, try to make sure that everybody is as healthy as possible for that Rams game. That is important. We'll see if it is a trap game as a result of that, but I would say 72% chance of victory. Also, what's the forecast? Has Sam Darnold played in the rain yet?
Sam Darnold could play in any weather.
I don't know that I'm comfortable saying that yet.
You think weather faces Sam Darnold?
The current forecast is mostly cloudy, 0.2 inches of rain, although it looks like more likely to rain in the late evening than during the NFL window. It looks actually like a really nice day to attend a football game for November. So, kind of wish the Huskies were at home on Saturday, I guess, based on that. Okay. All right, let's talk about the Mariners. MLB free agency opens Thursday when players can begin signing with new teams. We'll see how quickly things move, which is usually not very up until then. Teams able to decide on options. And the Mariners have officially exercised their club option on Andrés Muñoz for $6 million. Which comes as no surprise whatsoever.
Hello. This was a done deal. It's nice to see it happen officially.
Yeah. I would ask if you had any thoughts on the World Series, but we have recorded for far too long already. All right, roundup time. Seattle Kraken beat Chicago 3-1 on Monday and now have earned points in five consecutive games. They keep doing this while Giddy outshot. And you think that look just like Alex Meyer, they can't keep getting away with it, but they do. In Saturday's overtime loss to the Rangers, the Kraken were outshot 27-13, yet still earned a point. They'll wrap up this homestand Wednesday with San Jose before a weekend back-to-back at St. Louis in Big Ten country and Dallas. Then they start a three-game homestand next Tuesday against Columbus. Some PWHL Seattle news. They are set to reveal their team name on Thursday, but they may have accidentally leaked that team name on their website ahead of time. It's this apparently the Seattle Torrent with a logo of a cloud of rain that really looks more like some sort of a natural phenomenon. That
what team is this?
Spells out Ness. That's PWHL Seattle, the new women's hockey team that is coming online later this month.
Torrent?
Torrent.
Like the shit that you do on your computer, like kids back in the day in colleges?
I believe the idea is torrent of rain.
Like BitTorrent?
Yes, about like that.
I'm going to give that one a maybe on torrent. I'm not sure on that one. Maybe they leaked it to be like, hey, this is like a bad name.
Like when the Sounders did
you
the poll.
You only think of the word torrent as in torrential. That's the only time you think about it in that tense.
I think, you don't I mean, think yes, it. I agree. Torrent. No one says a torrent of rain. Also, we don't get torrential downpour. That's not the type of rain we get.
Yeah, check your facts.
All right, Seattle Sounders news. Yeah, you're taken aback by that one.
I'm not sure about that one, but at least they can get a copy of 2001 by Dr. Dre and have the incorrect songs on it, or songs named incorrectly on it, the right songs but wrong names, out of order perhaps. The song about Easy at the end, just not on there.
Huge loss. All right, Seattle Sounders have evened their best of three series against Minnesota United in the first round of the MLS Cup playoffs with a wild 4-2 win Monday night. The Sounders completely dominated the first 45 minutes, getting an early goal from Obed Vargas in the 8th minute, a second from Jordan Morris in the 21st, and a third from Danny Musovski in the 41st. But they, unlike the Seahawks, wanted to keep things interesting. Or maybe like the Seahawks against the Texans, I guess. They allowed the Loons to score twice in stoppage time in the first half to make it a one-goal game. They then righted the ship after halftime, and Obed Vargas scored a second in the 86th minute to seal the win. The 4-2 scoreline, probably higher scoring than it should have been. Sounders had 2.1 XG to 0.8 for Minnesota, so neither team creating that much offense. But the encouraging piece of this is that, you know, there was a bit of a theory based on the Sounders' last match against Minnesota in particular, and then the first game of this series where they built up these high XG and failed to score. Like, maybe there's something Minnesota is doing that's causing them to, you know, be not actually giving up as threatening chances as they seem like. The answer is no. Soccer is very random, and two games is a small sample size. But the Sounders did make a change. Brian Schmetzer decided to start Jordan Morris and Danny Musovski together up top, both of their strikers, in a change from what we've seen most of the season. And it certainly seemed to work wonders with the three goals in the first half. Sounders did lose Alex Roldan at halftime of this game due to groin tightness, with Kalani Kosa-Rienzi replacing him. No update yet on his availability for the deciding game of this one on Saturday in St. Paul, game three of the series. The winner will face the winner of San Diego and Portland, who are also headed to a game three on Sunday after the Timbers won a shootout last Saturday. Seattle Reign FC finished fifth in the NWSL standings with a draw Sunday at Orlando, setting up a rematch of the same two teams in the same place on Friday. The Reign had already announced before this game that if that came to play, they would stay in Orlando for the week, so plenty of opportunities to visit the Magic Kingdom as they practice this week. After relatively little action in the first 70 minutes, the teams traded goals late. Defender Carson Pickett scored for Orlando in the 76th, and Jordan Bug equalized for the Reign, another defender, 3 minutes later. So again, Reign is the 5 seed, faced the 4 seed Pride, who won the NWSL double last year, earning the regular season shield and then winning all three of their playoff games in 90 minutes without needing extra time or penalties. Orlando won 8 of the first 12 matches this season, but then were winless between June 13th and September 26th. During that span, they lost 2024 MVP Barbara Banda on August 16th to a full thickness tear of her adductor tendon, ending her season. Pride did, without her, finish strong with 4 wins, no losses in their last 5 matches to secure home field in the opening round. Orlando, not a really potent attack. They scored 33 goals, more than only the Reign among playoff teams, but they allowed just 27, the third fewest in NWSL, to maintain a positive goal differential. Marta is their leading active scorer, the legend, with 4 goals after scoring 9 in 2024, which we thought might be her swan song. The longtime Brazilian standout came off the bench for 2 October appearances before starting against the Reign and playing 80 minutes. Manager Seb Hines told the NWSL broadcast that it's a matter of finding the best role for Marta, who is now age 39. Seattle Storm news. Dominic Malunga officially announced last week is joining Unrivaled for year 2 of their competition. There's going to be a strong Storm flavor from last year's roster. You obviously already had Skylar Diggins participating in this, but this season, among the new players, we've got Erica Wheeler joining up, and now Dominic Malunga is going to be participating. So we talked a couple, well, I think it was last week, about how Dominic Malunga, because of breaking her contract, or I guess it was 2 weeks ago, with Fenerbahce to play in EuroLeague this offseason, needs to resolve that and get a letter of clearance from her team through FIBA in order to be eligible to play in the WNBA. That is not an issue for Unrivaled, because Unrivaled does not participate in FIBA's letter of clearance system. It is a 3x3 league, 3-on-3 league, as opposed to 5-on-5 basketball. So stay tuned on that one. Another bit of unrivaled news related to the Storm: former coach Noel Quinn was announced as one of the league's head coaches for the upcoming season. So it'll be nice to see Noel Quinn on the sidelines in unrivaled play this season. On Wednesday, we'll have a press conference to introduce Sonia Rahman as the Storm's head coach. So we'll report back on that one next week. Our UW basketball Monday was opening night of the college basketball season. Both Husky teams in action at Heck Ed Arena and a Heck Edmondson Pavilion at Alaska Airlines Arena in a doubleheader, starting with the women, who picked up a 90-43 win over Seattle U. They played without leading scorer Elle Ladine, who was not dressed for this one, but on the bench due to unspecified reasons. Tegan Brown started at guard, presumably in Ladine's place, alongside the expected trio of Avery Howell, Savia Sellers, and Hannah Steins, with transfer Yulia Grabovskaya at center. It was a strong debut for USC transfer Howell, who made all five of her shots, four of them from three, and scored 18 points. Sellers had 21 points, six assists, and four turnovers. But the most interesting performance was from Aussie freshman Sienna Harvey, who played the most minutes of any first-year player, 16, and scored 15 points on 6 of 10 shooting in that span. Five-star recruit Bryn McGahee, the Spokane product, had 4 points in 12 minutes off the bench. Huskies should get a bit more of a test next Monday, hosting Montana. The Grizzlies, you'll recall, actually beat the Huskies 82-68 last year in Missoula. That was an outlier during a 14-18 season that led to a coaching change midway through for Montana. Men's basketball in the nightcap earned a 94-50 win over Arkansas Pine Bluff. Discussed last week, this is not an intimidating Arkansas Pine Bluff team, rated next to last in the KenPom rankings coming in, lost their games against major conference foes last year by an average of 50 points, but still just nice to see the Huskies comfortably. This was their biggest win in a couple of years. Nice to see the Huskies, or maybe longer than that, nice to see the Huskies comfortably dominate a game. Did you watch this one?
No, I don't think I have Big Ten Plus. Is that?
Oh, you probably do not have Big Ten Plus. That is true. So... the story, again, from a Husky.
You're complaining about how long the podcast is taking, so I was just letting you talk there.
Well, now we're,
That must be the longest monologue in Pelton Cast history.
I think there have been a lot longer monologues than that. So J.J. Mandaquit started a point guard again for the Huskies. They started pretty much the same lineup that they started against in the exhibition against UNLV. Desmond Claude still out. He's still expected back relatively soon. Did get Zoom Diallo and Kwamari Peterson back in bench roles, and they played considerably off the bench. Lathan Somerville was the other reserve, but J.J. Mandaquit starts at guard with Wesley Yates the third, Bryson Tucker and Hannah Steinbach at forward, and Frank Kepnong at center. And the story once again, I guess the story is the depth. Huskies had five players in double figures. Lathan Somerville scored 9 points. Kepnong had seven with nine boards. So a lot of balance here. Double-double for Bryson Tucker with 12 points and 10 rebounds in his official Husky debut. Diallo with 14. Kamari Peterson with 13. Made four threes off the bench. The threes a welcome sight after the team struggled shooting. But it's really Hannes Steinbach. 28 minutes in his official NCAA debut, 21 points, 9 of 11 shooting, 7 rebounds, 6 assists, made a 3 in this one, had an incredible sequence, I don't know if you saw this, where he makes a turnaround jumper, looks a little like maybe another certain other tall German player, I would say, goes back and blocks a shot on the other end, and then coming the other way in transition, finishes the play with a monster dunk. This guy's really good.
I haven't seen Hannes Steinbach play, but I think we're kind of entering into the territory of Sunday night. It's going to be very exciting.
We'll get to it.
But we're entering into the territory of we're only going to get like 30 of these chances to see Hannes Steinbach play as a Washington Husky. We better enjoy every single one of them that we can, if it's Arkansas Pine Bluff or whatever.
So you're saying you're going to have to get Big Ten Plus.
But I'm saying that there's conference games or near conference games coming up very, very soon.
That's
and
true.
We better be dialed in on these games because, again, there just aren't that many chances to see him play.
Many people are saying UW men's basketball is Steinbach. So to your point about the upcoming week, on Thursday, the Huskies host number 335 in the KenPom rankings, Denver. The Pioneers went 11-21 last year, lost their season opener 84-73 at Seattle U Monday night in the debut of former Minnesota University Moorhead coach Tim Bergstrater on the sidelines. But Sunday, things get very real as the Huskies head to Waco to take on Baylor. A Baylor team that is unranked for the first time in a while to start the season, but they're number 21 in KenPom. This is an interesting situation because Baylor returns zero players from the 2024-25 team that lost in the NCAA tournament in the second
round.
That's
incredible. Zero players?
According to their game notes, there are three teams nationally. The U is one of them. I forget who the third one was. I want to say maybe Maryland, but I'm not sure. So VJ Edgecombe was the number three pick in the draft by the Philadelphia 76ers. Odds on rookie, your favorite at this point. Norchad Omir and Jeremy Roach, college veterans, also exhausted their eligibility. I think there was one other player was out of eligibility. And then basically everyone else transferred.
I mean, it seems kind of strange that everybody would transfer given how many roster spots there are, but maybe it's just a money issue.
I don't know exactly what happened, but it's a fresh start for Baylor under Scott and Coach Scott Drew, a national champion coach. After playing sparingly in his two seasons at Tennessee, guard Cameron Carr was the star on Monday night in his Waco debut, exploding for 28 points against UT Rio Grande Valley while shooting 9 of 14 from the field, 3 of 6 from 3. Freshman Tunde Yesufu is the name to watch. He's a potential one-and-done prospect, had 24 points and 7 boards in his NCAA debut. So, you know, it's only one game with a team that had literally never played none of them had ever played for Baylor before. It's a little hard to know what to make of this, but it is unquestionably a very real test and a very real showdown and a preview of what's ahead in conference play for the Huskies.
It's a blank slate as far as Baylor goes, but I think winning would be a big deal. How about
be a
that?
Huge deal.
And winning comfortably would be an even better deal. We're going to learn more about what Baylor is going forward, but like, the 21 in KenPom is almost completely based on priors, as far as I can tell, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they actually dropped because they played relatively close. They started out number 17. Ken Pomeroy has, not the singer, obviously, has talked about one of the factors going into the projections now is basically how much historically do coaches outperform their team's projections over the course of the season. And I believe that Scott Drew was one of the coaches who notably outperformed and therefore was, that's a big factor in this.
Okay. I mean, fair enough. We'll see on this one, kind of for both teams, but I think we have a pretty good sense that Hans Steinbach is a very, very good player and it'll be a chance to see him on a national stage and to really let us know it's going to happen Sunday, right? Like, things can change for the Huskies if they lose this game, but if they win this one, we will have a good sense of what this Husky team is.
UT Rio Grande Valley, as I look at this box score, has one of the all-name team guys, always right, started for them.
Always right.
Yeah. Transfer from Rhode Island. They had UT Rio Grande Valley in this game had 2 offensive rebounds against 30 defensive rebounds for Baylor. So Huskies are going to need to do better than that, I would say, on the offensive glass. That's what jumps
if we're
out.
Comparing the Washington Huskies to UT Rio Grande. Okay.
Baylor had a 32-11 advantage in free throw attempts, but shot just 66% at the line. So they're going to have to do better than that.
All of this information is relevant.
a semi-familiar face, Michael Ratai, is a transfer who spent 4 years at Oregon State before heading to Baylor this year.
Who can forget him?
All right, let's talk about UW football. Which
Hello.
Is ranked for the first time this season, first time since the end of the 2023 season, at number 24 in the AP poll. And on Tuesday night, the inaugural college football playoff rankings came out, featuring the Huskies at number 23.
They became ranked in the AP poll the second that the AP poll stopped mattering. And that is a fine thing for me because the college football playoff understands how these things work way more than the AP does. The AP could go fuck themselves, for all I'm concerned. Totally off in every capacity. The college football playoff understood the value of the Big Ten. Way more Big Ten teams in this. Iowa unranked in the AP poll. Number 20 in this poll. A team that will not be named much lower, three spots lower in the college football playoff, a team that's played very badly, just barely beat Wisconsin, about to lose to that Iowa team this weekend. The college football playoff rankings are the only rankings that matter. The AP is done. They are gone forever. Goodbye. The Huskies are number 23 in the country. It matches where they're at in FBI, I believe, or at least very, very close. These are the rankings that matter. And being at number 23, and I would say the respect that was given to the Big Ten in this, despite the fact that if you read a certain website, they might think that the college football playoff would be all 12 teams from the SEC somehow. There are actually teams from other conferences that are being considered for the college football playoff. So feeling very good about where the Huskies sit right now, coming off the bye week. It seems like they did value the Illinois victory a little bit there. And they're in a prime position that if they are able to, people are so worried about whether the Huskies would make the playoff if they went out. It's like, motherfucker, just go win out, right? Like, we can't control anything else, but this is the type of situation.
Go win out. Win Saturday.
Win Saturday, win the next Saturday, win the next Saturday. That's all you could do. All you could do is win and not be worried about all these other things that are happening. It is nice to be right now ranked in the college football playoff. And do you know what that means long term?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. So they have to go win on Saturday against Wisconsin.
I wish there was a Friday game in there so I could have corrected you, but I don't believe there is. A little bit of UW news coming out of the bye week. Jed Fish said Monday that receiver Rasheed Williams, they expected him back as he was recovering from the collarbone injury he suffered in week two, instead suffered a hand injury during practice last week and will miss at least a few weeks. So kind of a lost season for Rasheed Williams. It'll be interesting to see if he can crack the receiver rotation when he's back, given how well the freshman had played in his absence. But Huskies will get back senior tight end Quinton Moore. Ended up doing much better than expected after the scary injury he suffered against Michigan that sent him to a nearby hospital. So very excited to see him back on the field and add to that depth at tight end, where the Huskies are still down Cade Eldridge. All right, Wisconsin. 0-6 against major conference opponents. All six of those losses have come by at least 14 points. This has been, in what I informed you about earlier today offline, a brutal schedule. They have played three of the top six teams in the AP, current AP polls. I guess only three of the top nine by the college football playoff rankings, plus Michigan and Iowa, who, as you mentioned, is now ranked in the college football playoff. They're not the rankings. They're not the AP. The one game that they played that was relatively light, they lost 27-10 at home to Maryland. Wisconsin, number 103 in FBI efficiency, number 126 on offense, which is pretty rough. San Diego State transfer Danny O'Neill, no, not that one, began the year as QB1, lost his job in September after throwing five picks in four games. Hunter Simmons, who transferred in with three career starts under his belt at Southern Illinois, has been little better, throwing five picks in his four starts. He was below 40% completions against both Iowa, going 8-for-21, and Oregon, 7-for-21, which look probably more like you'd like your three-point shooting to look than your completion percentage for your starting quarterback. Wisconsin has given four running backs at least 30 carries this season. Only
do we know who's
them...
starting on Saturday? Do we have? Is it Hunter Simmons?
I didn't know that there was any reason to question that.
Okay. I mean, the reason to question is because they've all been really, really bad.
Yes, but they keep playing him.
So. He's the latest really, really bad quarterback to play, so fair enough.
Yeah, I don't see any reporting that they're considering a change right now. I mean, I suppose you can't rule it out.
Yeah, Hunter Simmons is listed as number one on the depth chart for them.
Have given four running backs at least 30 carries. Only one of those is averaging more than 4.7 yards per carry. They are last in Big Ten in yards per carry as a team, and rushing TDs, and also passing TDs, because of course they are. The Wisconsin defense has actually been pretty good on the ground, all things considered, allowing just 110.8 yards per game and 3.7 yards per carry, to spending basically all of their games trailing. Their issue, alas, has been pass defense. Opponents are completing a Big Ten high 69% of their passes for 8.1 yards per attempt, which ranks 16th of the 18 conference teams. They got diced up by Julian Sain, who might be better than we allowed early in the season. He's 36 of 42.
I mean, I just compared Sam Darnold to Julian Sain, so it's you true. Know that I have changed my perspective on Julian Sain.
It's true. I'm acknowledging it. 36 of 42 for 393 yards and four touchdowns. Ty Simpson went 24 of 29 for 382 four yards, but they did somehow limit Dante Moore to 86 yards on 9 of 15 completions.
The
low
reason for
game.
That is because Dante Moore sucks is actually the reason for that. Not somehow, it's because Dante Moore sucks. As just, I have said consistently, Dante Moore is not a good quarterback.
Just why?
Keep projecting him number one overall. Keep, please, why? Keep projecting him number one overall.
What benefit would you have from saying this before the Huskies face Oregon?
But that's weeks from now. Come on, they're going to have three losses by then.
There's no upside to saying that. Do watch out for wide receiver Vinny Anthony on kick returns. He has averaged 28.6 yards per turn with a touchdown after averaging 27.9 last year. A truly amazing stat. Wisconsin all season has attempted just 5 field goals. Only Kent State with 4 has tried fewer.
I mean, they had back-to-back weeks that they didn't score. So
still,
they just haven't really scored a lot of points this year. So
haven't gained a lot of yards.
When you don't score many points, you don't kick a lot of field goals either.
It is true.
So I sort of have this perspective of there are certain games that are going to be hard games no matter what. There are places that UW's never played, right? Or maybe not never, but as a Big Ten team, UW has never been to Wisconsin and played a game at Camp Randall Stadium. It is not an easy place to go play a game. I feel the same way about Iowa. I feel the same way about Minnesota, right? Those blue blood, and obviously Michigan, Ohio State, teams like that. Those blue blood Big Ten teams, when you're going on the road to play against them, it is never an easy place to play. I think Wisconsin has been so demoralized by this season that I think some of that element of it is difficult to go to Wisconsin and play is a little bit mitigated by that and just how bad the quarterback play has been for them, that there's just the fan base. And again, we're not there, but the fan base can't be feeling particularly great right now in Wisconsin. And I think their number one focus is probably on wanting Luke Fickell out and not necessarily the Washington Huskies at this point. It's maybe one of their last chances at a victory, but like we're talking about the 126th best offense, the 53rd best defense. That's the part that you said was good about Wisconsin.
I mean, I said the run defense was good. The Huskies last played Wisconsin in 1992. They made a one-off visit to Husky Stadium in week 2 of that season. The defending national champions, in the midst of their winning streak, defeated the Badgers 27-10. Their last visit to Camp Randall Stadium came in 1968.
Wow.
The Huskies won 21-7. Huskies have, according to sportsreference.com, never lost to Wisconsin. They beat them 17-0 in the first game of that home and home in 1967. And then in the 1960 Rose Bowl, took down Wisconsin 44-8.
Yeah, they're one of those teams, like every once in a while you just have those teams that you just, you know, Nebraska's a team that we just played. And Wisconsin is, I feel like, one of the sort of few major, like, Big Ten teams that we've just never really had a rivalry with. We've never run into them almost anywhere.
It's weird because of the fact that there is an inherent tension over who is the real UW.
Yeah. No, Oregon's kind of been the Ohio State team. We're kind of the Michigan team. Oregon's the Ohio State team. But I think They've also played Wisconsin, right?
Oregon and Wisconsin? Yeah, I feel like
they played a Rose Bowl.
Rose Bowl. Yeah.
Yeah. So UW, when they have played against, it's a little bit tough to say because Wisconsin's not a good defense, but better defenses on the road. Maryland ranks 19th. Michigan ranks 20th. They have struggled a little bit against those teams. And this still would be one of the better defenses. You know, after those two, this is the best defense that they played on the road. So I don't know if it's a given, but I do think the piece of Wisconsin's offense being so bad and UW's defense being maybe commensurately like about similar to where Wisconsin's defense is, I think actually a little bit better. The Husky defense is a little bit better than Wisconsin. It's just going to be so hard for them to move the ball that it would take for this game to be close. A situation of the Huskies aren't finishing drives, turnovers, just some nonsense happening along the way. And I do think they can, just given their normal defense and offense, how it's functioned, you know, they're 66 in defense. So their defense is worse than Wisconsin's, but how their offense has functioned and played against teams like Illinois is also a pretty good defense. I just am not concerned about this one.
The Huskies, the sports information department on the game preview, it reminds us, had a home and home scheduled with Wisconsin for 2018 and 19 that the Badgers backed out of after the Big Ten
said they
moved to a 9-game conference schedule.
They were scared to come here. Revenge!
They should have maybe backed out of that Alabama game.
Yeah. 18 and 19 Huskies were like fine, right? 18, they went to the Fiesta Bowl, and then 19, they were bad. Is that right? Or not bad, but they were okay.
19 was the Jacob Eason year, yes.
It was Chris Peterson's last year.
Yep.
So I don't know. I mean,
18 was the year, that, by the way, that they won the Pac-12 and lost in the Rose Bowl. 17
went to the Rose
was the year
Bowl.
They went to
okay,
the festival.
Yeah. When they played Ohio State in the Rose Bowl.
Yep.
So I just don't see it being a great recipe to beat the Huskies. And I do think that it's a beaten down Wisconsin team at this point. That's kind of all there is to it. They don't have the quarterback play. I mean, Iowa beat them 37-0.
Huskies are 11.5 point favorites in this one. Percentage chances of victory?
85%.
Oh, interesting. We're on the same page on this one. I was also 85%.
What was the score of that game back in 1992?
The score in 1992 was 27-10.
That feels about right. I think maybe we get one more score in there, but they'll give up some points. They'll give up a touchdown.
I don't know if they can match the 44-8 win on the Rose Bowl in the Rose Bowl.
What year?
1960.
They're going to match one of those. I'm feeling fine about this one.
Huskies were actually lower ranked in that one. Wisconsin was number 6 coming in. So back then there was a Big Ten bias.
Ron Dayton could never. No, it's kind of, I mean, it's fun playing these teams, you know, playing Big Ten teams that we haven't played yet.
Yeah.
And seeing them. I mean, it's the same with next week. 2 weeks from now, UCLA. Haven't ever played at UCLA as a Big Ten team before.
I mean, that is factually accurate, but they have played UCLA as a Big Ten team. Purdue, it's been a minute.
No, I think Purdue, I think these next two are going to be kind of fun. The combination of, we're in it.
Do we play Purdue in the El Paso, you know, the Sun Bowl in like 2003, I want to say?
We played them in the Rose Bowl, you're saying?
Yeah. Oh, no, maybe it was the Holiday Bowl. I don't know. The Huskies have played Purdue and
I want to say they played Curtis Painter. Is that right?
No, oh, I don't know. That's asking a lot of me. Let me go back into the archive here on sportsreference.com and check this one out. I suppose we could wait till the Huskies actually play Purdue, but
no, we have to know now.
we're in the spirit. Yes, the 2002 Sun Bowl.
They played them back-to-back years?
They were back-to-back years, but not back-to-back seasons, because the 2001 Rose Bowl was the 2000 season.
I see.
But they played literally as far apart as you can play.
Oh, it was Kyle Orton.
And then also played them a home-and-home in 19... They played them 4 consecutive years as part of a home-and-home between 1987 and 1990. I have no memory of those games.
Kyle Orton and Cody Pickett. I kind of remember that Sandiford receiver too.
Oh, he was, I think, part of the Rose Bowl team.
I think he was. Was he white? John Sandiford. That sounds.
Yeah, he had 62 catches for 677 yards as a freshman on the Rose Bowl team. Then had 13 touchdowns that season. Missed Kyle Orton, it seems like, the next year when he had just 4 touchdowns as a senior.
All right, well, that's been UW's history against Purdue for some reason.
Not expecting to remember John Standiford, but of all the guys, he definitely is one.
They do have this on UW Athletics. They have our history versus the team and all the games listed out.
Yeah. All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Zach, we did want to give you the opportunity while you're here. You have not heard this yet. The listener will have heard this.
We'll do
Tristan
this.
has
We'll
just declared
do the end of the podcast.
Sam Darnold the greatest quarterback on planet Earth.
Wait, does Damon Williams know you've done this?
Oh.
That's a great point, actually. I hadn't considered that. Does Damon Williams know you've done this? No, I mean, it's just basically like the level of play in the NFL is higher than the level of play in
Oh, yeah.
college. So once Damon Williams gets to the NFL, that conversation may change.
Kevin, can I ask you a question about this?
Sure.
I know football is not necessarily the specific area where you assess this, but because I've been thinking a lot about it with Sam Darnold and in particular, and I think with some other guys too, and the conversation around him, and we saw this with Geno to some extent when he took over as a starter here too. Like, as an analyst or maybe even as a fan, at what point do you kind of have to perhaps purge your early career impressions of a player when they sort of materially show you, or perhaps materially show you, that they are not the same player? Because I think a lot of the conversation around Darnold, yeah, people are like, well, he had two bad games at the end of 2024. But I really think most people who are hesitant to talk about him being a player on the level that he's shown over the last 2 years is like, well, we saw him look like shit with the Jets when he was just a newly drafted player and early in his career. And I just tend to think that, again, I'm not saying that Sam Darnold is the best quarterback on planet Earth. I think he's just one of the five best quarterbacks on planet Earth. I'm reasonable over here, but I think
You're
that,
a hater,
like,
is what you're
yeah,
saying.
right, totally a confirmed hater. But I think that there's something about, like, I get it. Everyone is a little bit afraid. Like, I think it's easier to kind of take a player who's, like, I was listening to a podcast, where they were discussing, midseason awards for the NFL, and there was a lot of conversation around, who should be the MVP and or who has been the MVP so far, and Darnold was obviously a part of that conversation, and both of the people kind of came to the conclusion of Drake May, and I'm like, I kind of get it on the one hand, but part of it just feels like to me, like, well, we haven't seen Drake May be bad, so it's easier
Oh,
and
yeah.
safer to pick him because, like, he's a second year player and he's playing really well, and like. To me, it's like, but that sort of feels like it feels like a sort of, I don't want to say lazy, that's the wrong way, but it feels like being unnecessarily cautious, or maybe unnecessarily cautious. So I don't know. I asked you a question, I should let you answer instead of just talking.
Drake May ahead of Sam Darnold in projected Qbert from Nate Silver's metric. I was curious about that. May is fifth and Darnold is seventh. So only the seventh best quarterback on
Wait,
planet Earth,
what is
perhaps.
the cube, what is that a ranking of?
That's like their it's like their FPI versus the FPI efficiency, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? It's
No.
like Darnold's
So it weighs
performance
past performance as well.
Darnold's performance this season
Oh,
is
okay.
number one, but his like talent level is considered to be number seven.
I mean, that's still pretty, like, if we're talking about Sam
Still better
Darnold.
than 8 billion people either way.
Yeah, but even if you're like it's factoring in past performance, that's still pretty fucking high on Sam Darnold. It's
Oh
higher than
yeah,
he's getting
no.
paid at the very least.
No,
Right.
I mean, I agree with that. It would be interesting if Sam Darnold hit the market again this year. I mean, I think what makes it somewhat different in football than basketball is, number one, like, the sample size is inherently smaller because you've only got 17 games as opposed to 80 games in an NBA regular season. And like, there are certain areas that can be kind of fluky. Like, if a guy is shooting three pointers, obviously way above their career level, like, there's some skepticism that might regress. But like, players don't like go from, 20% usage to 30% usage and it's just a fluke. Like, that settles down pretty quickly. So I think it's maybe easier for us in basketball to do it. And those transformations tend not to happen as quickly as they have, I think, in this modern era with quarterbacks. Like, I'm trying to think about, like, Victor Oladipo when he went to the Pacers, but it's not like he emerged as an MVP caliber player. There's not like a good example that I can think of off the top of my head of somebody who's gotten to like that, top five level in the NBA who was like objectively bad at some point other than just like, they were a 19-year-old in the NBA.
Right. I mean, I wonder if
So,
some of that is a function of quarterbacks specifically or the
right.
position specifically, where like you can't be a low usage quarterback. I mean, you can be a relatively low usage quarterback in some sense, but
There's a
like you
Brock
can't
Purdy
be
debate
a
here.
right.
I mean, Darnold's a low usage quarterback in a lot of ways. Like
Sure.
If I was actually trying to look for a knock on Darnold being the best quarterback on the face of the earth, which I'm not, it's he's just thrown so many less passes than almost any of the other people we're talking about.
Well, he hasn't actually needed to throw very many, which I think is probably a good, like, has worked pretty well. Like, when you are, you know, throwing them as, you completing as many of them for as many yards as you, as they are, like, the field is only 100 yards long. You can't help it if you just keep scoring touchdowns.
You run, well, also, run out of yardage to gain.
Dominating these teams so early in the games that he's, you know,
but I guess
hasn't really
I guess
had to try later on.
I mean, to come back to the point, or go ahead, Kevin. Sorry.
Well, I think what's interesting is, like, if you actually were making the anti-Sam Darnold argument because we're trying to keep his extension reasonable, whenever that inevitably happens, you'd point out, look, he's only fifth in EPA plus CPOE composite on third and fourth downs, and that's the real measure of passing ability against a defense that knows
he
it's coming.
He drops all the way down to fifth.
Yeah.
I mean,
the
look,
I told you,
agreed.
Top five.
He's not a truly elite quarterback. Like, you know who is number one in this category, because Ben Baldwin did post about this today. Can
is
you guess?
Jacoby Brissett?
No, it's more
Matthew Stafford.
Is it Flacco?
No, it's somebody we've brought up in this conversation.
Oh, it's Drake
Gino?
May?
Drake May is number two. No, okay. No, it's definitely not Gino.
No, it's like not this year. No, definitely.
It's Daniel Jones is number one in those situations. It's someone else who I think would be, like, accused of, oh, he's just taking advantage of these stacked boxes because of Jonathan Taylor. So, like, that's maybe the more true measure of quarterback. Jackson Dart is right behind him at six, so right ahead of Patrick Mahomes. Now you know the truth. Jackson Dart better than Patrick Mahomes.
But again, they're looking at, you know, half of a season of a itself small sample. Like, I don't know that you can necessarily weigh too much of that. But again, I want to kind of make this point really quickly, which is, again, I think part of it is, like, quarterback, if you're a highly drafted player, you know, a top half of the first round quarterback, you are, you know, at least to this point, like, you're put out there and everyone sees you fail if you're not immediately successful. And I think it becomes very easy to sort of, like, assume that that play, like, the growth that Sam Darnold and, you know, maybe Daniel Jones and Baker Mayfield and other players who fit this archetype have had has in some part been behind the scenes. Yeah, Gino too. I mean, Gino even more, you know, a little bit different because he was a second round pick and was a backup for a long time. But all these guys had a period of time where they were, you know, they were obviously the starter from a very young age and struggled, you know, differing degrees, and then had a period of time where they were not the starter. And I think, like, it's not to say that every quarterback who fails as a high draft pick and then has a backup role is going to be good. But I think that, like I said, like, we don't, like, in the NBA and maybe in even in baseball to some extent, you can have a player grow kind of in a natural progression where they're not necessarily front and center from the moment they debut in the, you know, the professional level or at the top level. And quarterback, you can't not be the starting quarterback. Like, there's no, you know, there's no relief quarterback. I mean, not yet, maybe one day. And there's no way to hide. And so I think, just again, to come back to the kind of question I asked, like, I do think that some of the thing with Darnold and maybe with Jones and some other guys too, is, like, there's just, we've seen them be bad. And so it becomes very hard to shake that image. I just think it's not necessarily right to look at them and say, well, the player they were when they were 21, 22, 23 is just, that's really who they are, and all the stuff they're doing now, that's a facade, that's fake. They're, it's all scheme or it's luck or it's who knows what. I just think, like, you know, it's not unreasonable to me to think that these guys who are, you know, have now been in the NFL for 5, 6, 7 years, have had a chance to be professionals for a while, have grown in a lot of different ways, probably could just genuinely be better. And in the case of Darnold in particular, like, the question with Darnold was never his talent. Like, everyone knew Sam Darnold was an exceptionally talented player from the time he was at USC. It's just, we might have gotten to a point where the other things that go into playing quarterback have caught up to his talent. And I mean, it's been a hell of a lot of fun to watch.
To go back to your question, I think the other advantage, like I mentioned, the 82 games versus 17 in the regular season, probably the bigger advantage is the playoffs, where even though it's a relatively, like, not against a variety of different opponents, if you play a series, you at least get four games. You know, it's some things even out. Sam Darnold had one playoff game that people based a lot off. And the ultimate answer to this is, people will believe it when Sam Darnold does it in the playoffs.
Right.
That's when they will believe it. So I do think that is a reasonable comparison to, like, I don't
if
know.
If he finishes
the right
this full season where he's at right now, Sam Darnold is going to be considered one of the best quarterbacks in the league.
Maybe, like, Jalen Brunson is the example, by the way.
Jalen Brunson was literally who I had up. But Jalen Brunson also is a usage thing, too. It's not like he was, like,
He wasn't
bad
bad.
necessarily.
Yeah, he just changed. He was low ceiling and then became.
But I guess we see young players in the NBA, and again, Kevin, you know better than I do, who are sort of from an efficiency standpoint.
I mean,
bad.
Kevin Durant's rookie season.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe there it's a different story because everyone could see the talent, even though
right.
like the efficiency was bad. But like, you know, young high draft pick player on bad team is going to get a lot of, you know, opportunities to be, you know, good or bad. And like, it doesn't, we don't necessarily look at that and say like, well, yeah, this guy sucked as a rookie or as a first, his first 2 years and he's doomed. Although I do think that, you know, maybe it's true that some of that stuff is indicative of the trajectory of their career in some cases. And I think it is with quarterbacks too. I think a lot of the time guys who are bad when they're young, that just may be the reality of it. I just think it's when they've shown you some other side of them, I don't think you necessarily have to hold on to, you know, whatever it is the, you know, with Darnold, it's the memes, right? It's the seeing ghosts, it's the mononucleosis, it's all that shit that like is sort of fun in some sense. And like, I think, you know, hopefully he, you know, that is something that we kind of look at as more like, well, that was what a progression he's had from there. But I think it's like, it's also kind of weird to hold on to that too much from, you know, again, a long time ago.
Yep. I agree. I also was even thinking about like Joe Flacco this year. It's like three games, but his QBR with the Browns, 31, 24, 34, 15, 73 in the last one. His QBR with the Bengals, 75, 47, 76. And it's just like Joe Flacco is not a different human being between those two teams, but the system is totally different for him there. And it is like I guess I hadn't considered necessarily the piece of like you're out there, everybody is seeing it, and you get judged very, very quickly as a quarterback. I do think the staying power in the league is a valuable thing, and the fact that teams still wanted Daniel Jones even after the Giants released him, and he still got that next deal. Same with Sam Darnold. You know, he was the backup quarterback with a very good team in San Francisco. Mac Jones is probably going to be a similar situation. You know, like you look at Mac Jones, and 5 years from now, we probably will be talking about Mac Jones as maybe even less, 2 years from now, talking about Mac Jones as a starting quarterback somewhere and just being able to hang on. Whereas like Josh Rosen is gone and
right.
Anthony Richardson is probably going to be gone. And like those players that the league sort of weeds out are just like those players are going to disappear into infinity. But like the coaches know and the GMs know of like, and usually it's the draft pedigree that it comes back to, but ultimately, if you're good enough to be drafted third overall, you're probably still good enough to be on a team as a backup quarterback when you're 27 or something like that and have time to figure it out.
But I think also some of it is probably like how many, some of those players, without knowing any of the specifics of any of those guys in particular, may not be willing to be a backup. Like, I think, you know, sometimes it's a case that, you know, if you were a highly drafted player, yeah, you're not making the money that a Mahomes or an Allen is making, but you're making a lot of money to be a quarterback for 4 or 5 years. And you may not decide, you may decide like, I don't really want to do what it is to be a backup quarterback. I think there is, it takes a certain level of, I don't know if it's humility or a certain level of belief in yourself in a way. Like I think Gino is a really good example of this. Like, you know, I think Gino was a backup because that was what was available to him, but I don't think he ever stopped thinking he could be a starting quarterback. I mean, you ask him, he obviously didn't stop thinking he could be a starting quarterback in the league. It took him a lot longer to prove that than it took Darnold or Mayfield or all those guys. But I think like for all of them, there's an element of, you know, they believed in themselves in a way and were willing to do what it took to stay in the league in a way that some guys may not. And that's, you know, whatever. I don't blame guys for just, you know, if they're like, it didn't work out, I got, you know, $25 million. Like I'm good. You know, I'd probably be good.
Well, that's going to start a 100 post thread on the Discord for sure.
Love it.
On that note, Zach, thanks so much for joining us and helping us complete the bracket here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to ask this. I actually think it is a Seahawks related thing because really that's the lens I'm thinking of it through. Do you think that there's like a tiny chance that John Schneider actually saw where the league is going in terms of like the true inefficiency being mid-priced quarterbacks, not quarterbacks on rookie contracts, and was like, you know, whether it was just happenstance when they traded Russ or, but it's like, it's been a thing that they've basically done since then, which obviously isn't that many years, but like, I think everyone was like, okay, they have to draft a quarterback. They have to draft the quarterback. And obviously they drafted Jalen Milroe. That's a kind of different thing, but I've just thought about a lot how, you know, how like that, the idea of like the rookie quarterback was like, well, you're not paying your quarterback very much money, which I think is works great if that quarterback is good, but I don't think it's actually that useful if the quarterback isn't really good, because I think you're seeing that with some teams now. things on teams now where, like, if you're like, I mean, again, maybe people have different feelings about CJ Stroud, but I think, and obviously the Texans have some other issues that are bigger than CJ Stroud. But I think people are like, wow, he's so great. And it's like, they were fine offense his rookie year. They weren't like great. And like, yeah, they're not paying him very much money, but by the time you get to the point where, you know, if the player needs to develop some, and they get to the point where you are paying them a lot of money by the fourth or fifth year, I don't know. To me, it's like, I would just rather be paying a guy who's proven something. And, you know, like, I mean, I mean, Darnold's maybe an unrealistic level of expectation
the
for anyone
on the face of the earth.
Yeah, right. Unrealistic.
I was thinking of this when we were talking about the previous conversation, though, which is, to me, if I was a GM, you get enamored with the draft and fans get enamored with the draft. You get really excited about it. But like, when you look at the players that are the most impressive are the ones who are on their rookie deals and are good, right? Like, right. Drake May it's kind of shocking. But if you look at the top 10 in QBR, it's Lamar, who's on his second deal. He was good right away. But, like, honestly, Lamar was probably just, like, a racism inefficiency. There's Darnold, Dak Prescott, Mahomes, Drake May, Jordan Love, Dimes, Herbert, Jalen Hurts, Stafford, Josh Allen, and then CJ Stroud. And it's like, most of them are quarterbacks on their second deals. The ones that are the valuable ones, like Jordan Love's getting paid also, right?
Yeah.
At this point, sat for a year and they basically drafted him in the first round and sat for a year. To me, if I was a coach, what I would be doing is I would be looking at who needed a quarterback, who didn't have one of those guys, would be looking at the quarterbacks who are in that like 15 to 32 range and being, Trevor Lawrence is probably overvalued as far as like league perception of him goes. But if there were a time that the Jags were done with Trevor Lawrence, I probably want to be the team that has Trevor Lawrence next. And we talked about this a few weeks ago, like Bryce Young, Kyler Murray. Like,
I say, Kyler is the guy who's going to be out there, like 100%.
Kyler, I mean, it might even swing too far the opposite direction that people might be like, oh, he's going to be the next Sam Darnold, which he had more success early on than Sam Darnold had early on. But that to me is kind of like, that's the sweet spot. Mac Jones is another one of this has worked out for these quarterbacks so many times now that like the Buccaneers are very happy about having Baker and the Colts are very happy about having Dimes. We're very happy about having Sam Darnold. So I do think, you know, like but to answer your question, I think the answer is no. And I think John Schneider got very lucky. Because I really think John Schneider is being honest when he talks about being enamored with like Josh Allen. I think they just wanted that type of quarterback, and I think they accidentally found Geno. Like, I'm not sure if they even really expected to have Geno be their guy. And I think maybe, I don't know, the Matt Flynn thing's kind of weird because they were trying to do that a little bit with Matt Flynn also.
I mean, maybe they thought Drew Lock was going to be the guy. They did trade for Drew Lock. So I think, though, to go back to the original question, like, I think Darnold is more a triumph of scouting than of strategy, is my sense. I mean,
oh, see, no, I totally disagree with that, though. I don't think the strategy was necessarily go find a market inefficient quarterback. I think they were like, Darnold, like, we talked about this when they signed him. It was kind of like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills here. When they signed Darnold, I was like, this is a quarterback coming off a 14-3 season that they went out and are paying like the 18th best quarterback in the league right now. And I feel like I was pretty adamant about whether or not this works out. This was a good decision because it being that bridge quarterback. I think John Schneider got really lucky, though. Like, the scouting of Darnold, they probably were like, this might be able to work with what we're doing, but it has worked way better than they could have. They didn't expect Darnold to be the best quarterback in the league.
I mean, they would have signed him to a 5-year contract if they thought he was going to be this good. I agree with that. But I'm saying just, I think that they identified the right player type to go after more than they were like specifically, hey, we don't want to pay at the top end of the market or even at the bottom of them or at the bottom end of the market. We want to go in between.
It is just kind of funny to me that like Sam Darnold was just like one of the better quarterbacks in the league last year. And everyone was like, well, he's not very good. And like, I get that there were reasons that people were skeptical, you know, offensive play caller, receivers, et cetera. But I'm like, again, like in some sense, you're like, you know, I'm sure there was a much more complicated process than just like, look at what he did from a scouting perspective. But it's not like, you know, it's not like he was a guy who was, you know, a backup who got in a couple of games. You're like, wow, I kind of like some of this stuff. Like,
right.
There was plenty of tape from 2024 Sam Darnold where you could make a pretty educated guess. And I think, you know, like you, Tristan, I was sort of just like, I was sort of agnostic about the keeping Geno versus not. But to me, I thought like what made sense to me was Darnold was a guy where, again, this is maybe exceeding even wildest dreams of upside, but you could say, like, there's a way that this works out where he's a better quarterback than you had. And at a minimum, you're paying him somewhat less. He's younger. And if it doesn't work out, you're not that committed to it. And I think, like, again, people just, like, I think there's something about, like, what I love about where the Seahawks are right now, which is they have just a lot of good players. And, you know, in a way, when you have a quarterback who you're not paying a ton of money to and who you didn't have to give a lot of draft assets to get, or any in this case, you have a better chance of having lots of good players. And I think fundamentally, like, the best way to win in the NFL is to have a lot of good players. And that is a, I think that is a way that is accessible to every team, because I think the idea of, like, well, you have to have one of the three best quarterbacks in the league, you know, you're just kind of locked out as a franchise if you don't have those guys. And yeah, that's a one pathway. You still have to do a good job of surrounding them with players. I mean, we've seen those guys, you know, Josh Allen has won a Super Bowl. Lamar Jackson has won a Super Bowl. Obviously part of that's because Mahomes has won a lot of Super Bowls, but still fundamentally it's like, it's not easy to have a bunch of good players, but I think it is easier to have a lot of good players than it is to find one of the three best quarterbacks in the league, except if you're the Seahawks, then you did that in free agency.
It's also easier to have one of the best quarterbacks in the league if you have a lot of good players, because if you have a lot of good players, it makes your quarterback look better, because right, everybody is functioning in the same offense. And if the Seahawks don't have Jackson Smith and Jigba, maybe Darnold isn't as good. You know, like, maybe Darnold's the 12th best quarterback in the league, something like that. So as a byproduct of having the good players around right, them and not paying the quarterback. I mean, no, I think you and I were the most adamant about the Darnold signing being like the right direction. Obviously it's worked out phenomenally. But I do,
I mean, I need to take victory laps after eating all those cookies, so it's good.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think John Schneider has gotten a little bit lucky a few times. And you know what? Like, it's just very strange to have a GM who is phenomenal for a period of time and then terrible for a period of time and then phenomenal again. And it's kind of like the whole thing feels like it's been reset to it feels like we are in exactly the same place as we were, because we did this with Russ rookie season two.
I don't think the election results were that good.
In 2012, they were all right.
No. I'm saying tonight.
Oh, tonight. Okay. Yeah.
I don't think we're fully back in 2012.
Fair enough.
We'll see. But it feels like this, Russ's rookie year, it was kind of like we were moving along and we were like, well, we know the defense is great and we know that the team overall is playing well, but we were still a little tenuous about what Russ could be. And obviously Darnold's a little bit different, but like, you reach a point in the season where you're like, yeah, we're the fucking best team. And I think the Seahawks have like hit that point over these last couple of weeks where it's kind of like, we're there, and we all knew internally that we were the best team before everybody else knew. And then eventually everybody else is going to find out. But
yeah, I think you get to the point too, where you just sort of say like, the odds are against them winning the Super Bowl because the odds are against any team winning a Super Bowl. But I don't think you look at them, to me, I don't look at them and think like winning a Super Bowl is going to require, you know, the sort of like Rube Goldberg contraption of like everything going right for them and everything going wrong for the other teams in the conference. Like, they're just one of the best teams in football. And if they win the Super Bowl, it's going to be because they're healthier than the other teams. They get a couple of breaks in the playoffs, et cetera, et cetera. It's not like, you know, again, I think we've had a lot of playoff-ish Seahawks teams since like 2015, where you're like, yeah, maybe they win a game, maybe they get a good matchup, maybe they, but like, you couldn't really honestly look at the team and say, I think this team can make the Super Bowl or win it. Like, and I think this team can. I don't necessarily think they will. I think that's a hard ask of any team, but I think it's just, and it comes back to this thing, which is like, since 2022, they have just consistently added good players to the team through the draft and other means in a way that, like, again, it's like every so often I go back and look at like 2013 to 2021 of the draft, and you're just like, they added so few good players to the team. I mean, they added some good players and draft nobody, but like, that is such a fallow period, part because they traded away a lot of picks, part because they made up a lot of bad picks. And like, whether that's because Schneider was bad at it or they got unlucky or it was Pete or who the fuck knows. But to me, it's one of those things where you just kind of look at it and you're like, fundamentally, the things that carry the two eras to the, you know, kind of or, you know, kind of bridge the two eras of like the team being a Super Bowl contender are like, they have a lot of good players because they made a lot of draft picks. They did a good job with those draft picks. And like, they haven't done a bunch of things that kind of cut themselves off from having a bunch of good players. And you need that because guys get hurt, you know, things happen. And, you know, it's why I was glad they didn't trade away any guys. Like, they're not in a position where they can afford to let a good player leave during the season. Yeah, they may not re-sign everyone. They can't. They won't be able to. But that's a problem for 2026. Like, that's what the next draft is for, and you know, all those other things. I think it's cool to see them get to a point now where, like, you see that critical mass of talent on the roster, mostly through the draft, but not exclusively. And that's like a super fun thing to root for. It's what I loved about those, that, you know, the early Legion of Boom teams. Like, they were really good, and you could see that not just in the stars, but in the players who supported them.
Yeah, I mean, the years where there used to be like multiple guys claimed off waivers every year,
right,
at the end of training camp.
I was thinking about the Jets, though, whereas like the Jets have the picks from the Jamal Adams trade, right? And they still don't have a good roster. And yeah. I don't even remember who they drafted with those picks anymore. But like,
Garrett Wilson was one of them.
I mean, yeah. But like they were never able to turn that into a roster. And obviously they made all these trades today, but it's kind of like, they didn't make the trades today as a byproduct of those picks. They made those trades because they had their own picks that were incredibly high and they still were bad. And it was like, it's not just obvious, like you accrue a bunch of picks and then all of a sudden you have a bunch of talent. Like, you can't fuck this up. And
but conversely, like, look at what the Seahawks did with the picks they got for Russ. Like,
No. The Russ, like, that's the entire core of the team, basically.
I mean, and some other good picks around that. But, you know, like, Charles Cross is maybe not a superstar, but he's a very good player. And, you know, Devin Witherspoon's awesome. And, like, they're just, like, they're not in a position where they have to, like, they can continue to bring in, you know, hopefully bring in good young players to somewhat, like, this is the thing that did them in the first go-around, which is, like, they tried to, I think, too much to sort of bring in, consolidate all that draft value into a player who they thought would do the thing, whether it was Percy Harvin or Jimmy Graham or, you know, other guys too. Like, and you just, I think fundamentally, like, you just got to kind of accept that you got to kind of bring guys in, you know, in the natural timetable of the league. And if you try and accelerate too much, I mean, again, they're fortunately, hopefully not going to end up where, like, you know, like, look at where Washington is, look at where Houston is, where they like try to go too fast. And like, they don't have picks and they're bad. Well, not bad. Houston's not bad, but they're not where they want to be.
They're not contenders.
Yeah. And they're just like, you're just kind of like, well, what are we doing now? And like, those teams have, you know, obviously players who they should be very excited about, quarterbacks they should be excited about. But like, fundamentally, I just think there's something to be said about the accumulation of talent over a few years. And then you feel it. And you really do. Like, I think you feel it with the Seahawks team, where it's just like, there are so many guys you see out there, like, you know, even when it's Ty Okada or some shit, like, you, these guys can make plays and they don't have, you know, they just don't have the kind of glaring weaknesses so far, at least, that you look at and say, like, that's, you can't be a serious contender with a guy with that player X. I mean, maybe Anthony Bradford is that guy. We will see. But I think outside of that, you're just like, there aren't a lot of guys you look at and like, that guy shouldn't be out on the field for a good team. And that's cool. That's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
All right. I really got to go. I got like sick kid. It's the end of the night for me, but this was really fun. I appreciate you guys having me on and let me talk for so damn long.
Awesome. All right. Have a good night.
Appreciate it, Zach. Have a good one. All right. On that note. Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.